We got a new agent?
Yeah, new agent.
I can call them. I'm in the wrong state. Meeting of the Human Resources. Back to order, please. Just for a few minutes.
Mr. Chairman, today we have a special presentation, and as you've heard me say before, I always come up here with mixed emotions. When someone has served their time and is in a position where they can retire, it's certainly a joyful time for them, but as agency head or as a department head, it's always a mixed emotion because I hate to see them depart. Today will be Wilfred Kane. Wilfred, could you come up, please? All of you know Wilfred is a facilitator, assistant, and friend of the commission. Today is officially his last commission day. Wilfred's been here almost as long as I have, and during that time we have become co-workers, friends. He's been one heck of a confidant when I had issues that I didn't like. Bill Pruitt had a ruling and understanding. We could complain, but we complained amongst ourselves. We did not complain out in the field, and so I used Wilfred from time to time as a sounding board, and he never, ever betrayed that confidence. He's never done anything I haven't asked him to do, and he has served the commission and the Commonwealth well during his tenure, and I'm going to miss him, and I think the agency is going to miss him. So, having said that, and at the risk of blowing my reputation as being somewhat of a hard individual, I'm going to go to the certificate, which I'm really not. I'm a softy.
Yeah.
Commonwealth of Virginia Marine Resources Commission hereby recognizes Wallace Wilfred Cale. Be it known on behalf of the members, employees, and friends of the commission, you are hereby recognized for your 13 years of service as a senior staff advisor and legislative liaison. The invaluable assistance you have afforded this agency, the staff and constituents during your tenure, your knowledge of the legislative process, your professional interactions, and assistance with media relations, and in particular, your journalistic expertise have enabled this agency to better serve as stewards of Virginia's marine and aquatic resources for present and future generations. I am pleased to confer upon you this certificate of distinguished service given under my hand and the seal of the Marine Resources Commission this 27th day of March, 2007, in the 231st year of the Commonwealth of Virginia. Congratulations and thank you.
Commission members, colleagues, and friends. I have as more mixed emotions, I think, than the commissioner. I have been looking forward to retiring. I have not been looking forward to leaving. I have enjoyed my time here immensely. There have been good days, there have been bad days. There have been great days and there have been sad days. But I think that overall, I have tried to do what military people strive to do at whatever level of operation they are. And that is, they come to a job and to a task, and they try to do that task as well as they can possibly do it, always striving to leave the job better than when they found it, so that their successors, who are better than they are, can take the job to another level. And that's what I hope will happen with this position. It has been really fun at times working with Commissioner Pruitt, working with Commissioner Bowman, two great people totally different people, but people who have one goal in their professional life, and that is that this agency be the best it can possibly be. I know because I was there and I've seen them work. You gentlemen who are here monthly, more frequent than that normally for committee work, have a way of observing the agency from one angle. When you work with these people that, who are behind me, many of whom seated, you find out how good they are, how well they do their job, and how important they are in the movement of the agency. I have enjoyed being associated with very good and very professional people, and I think it has made me a much better person. So I thank you, Commissioner. I thank all of you with whom I have served, the other 20-some-odd commissioners that I have dealt with through my time here at the agency and as a reporter from 1974 to 1992 covering the agency. I've enjoyed it. I hope to see you again. I intend to see you again and hope that we will all see each other as we move along in your professional careers and in my retirement. Thank you very much.
Next item on the agenda is Ronald C. Woods, permit number 07-196. Mr. Badger.
Mr. Commissioner, I'd like to, I plan on briefing both these projects, Mr. Woods and Mrs. Alice Morrison, excuse me.
Okay, Ms. Morrison will also be 07-0197.
That's correct.
Great. Can you do me a favor and do 8, 9, 10, 11, same time, Dave?
Can't do much about that, but I can go right to the staff recommendation if you like.
Something called due process around here we need to work with. Anyway, go ahead.
I don't know much about that. I've also got four additional aerial photographs for our orientation purposes.
Okay.
We don't consider this part of the record, considering that the board has also been to the site. If the commission agrees, we'll proceed.
Proceed.
This is a request of 26 freeholders of property in Northampton County for commission review of the February 21st, 2007 decision of the Northampton County Wetlands Board and Dunes Board to approve the installation of 120 linear feet of stone riprap each, extending into or onto the beach at their properties situated along the Chesapeake Bay in the Latimer's Bluff area of Northampton County. We can go to the slides. Thank you. So a quad sheet just showing the location of the project. It's about 1.2 miles north of the Toll Plaza and a little over a mile south of the Six Feet State Park Fishing Pier. This is one of the aerials. We're looking south, 13, Chesapeake Bay. The Latimer's Bluff subdivision as a whole is the area that's enclosed in woods. And, all in there. It's about 15 waterfront lots, maybe four or five interior lots. Again, another aerial. Now we're looking north. Kittuick State Park is just off the screen up here in the left, upper left. As you can see, there's quite a bit of erosion. Got 800 linear feet of bulkhead, of riprap already in place, and erosion continuing on down. Most of you, this is the Woods property, Morrison property, and Linderman property. The Lindermans are the protestants in this particular case. They got the petition together. Again, as you can see, there's severe erosion all in front of this property, continuing on down, and you can see the riprap that's already in existence. Again, this is one last one. These homes are approximately 130 feet from the escarpment, and again, erosion. You can see trees that are falling down here. There's a tree that just fell in the last month or so right there. And now these next three slides are are on both applications, and they're just general information about the subdivision. Latimer's Bluff, the circle, closer view of the subdivision itself. South of it is Nature Conservancy, and I believe eventually it will go to Fish and Wildlife. Closer view of the subdivision, Woods property, Morrison's, Linderman, Allison property is here, and this is bulkheaded from here this way. There's no bulkheads except for the 100 or the 800 linear feet for a mile north or south of this subdivision. Okay. Go right here. On March 5th, 2007, staff received a letter and petition for review of Mr. and Mrs. Henry Linderman on behalf of 26 freeholders of property in Northampton County. As such, the appeals are being considered timely under the provision of the code. What you have here is the drawing showing the Woods property lines, 120
feet. Hank, do me a favor. Move that mic just a little bit closer to you. I moved it away when I was talking, I think.
Okay.
Thank you.
I'm sorry. Is this better?
Yes, sir.
120 feet. It's approximately 130 feet to the revetment here, tying into the Allison property over here, which the riprap's already in place, and the proposed Morrison riprap in this area. Cross section showing the riprap, the grading of the bank back, stairway. And I'll leave this up for the Woods portion of this. Northampton County Wetlands Board held a public hearing on the Woods application on February 21st. Woods were represented by Mr. Wood was represented by his agent and contractor Steve Bunce. During the hearing, the board considered the VIMS report, Northampton County staff report, and recommendation and testimony provided by Mr. Bunce. Mr. Richard Ayers and Mrs. Linderman spoke in opposition to the project. The VIMS report stated that the proposed riprap revetment would result in impacts to approximately 480 square feet of jurisdictional beach. They stated that the preferred approach to shoreline protection along this beach shoreline was to enhance the natural capacity of the sand flat to provide the desired erosion protection. The two elements are required for this approach, a sand flat and a slope rock structure. The rock structure can be a nearshore sill, an offshore breakwater. In this particular case, I'm sure it would be an offshore breakwater. The Wetlands Board staff agreed that the VIMS report may be the better approach. However, designs submitted by the applicant must also be considered a valuable solution. Staff recommended the board approve the application's design and that a water quality impact assessment be submitted and approved before the wetlands permit is issued. Staff also stated in their shoreline erosion report that the erosion rate in this area was 3.2 to 5.3 feet per year, and this was based on a 1987 survey. Let's see. Mrs. Linderman, who has property to the site, stated that she was under the assumption that the shoreline was to remain unaltered when they purchased their property, and stressed that erosion was still occurring even though many of these riprap revetments had been installed. Mr. Richard Ayers with the shorekeepers noted that revetments eliminate beach area. Board member Dot Field stated that that most of the erosion appears to be coming from the upland at the top of the bank and not the toe, and the soil type may be an issue with drainage undercutting the top bank. Board member Bob Myers agreed, noting that the soil was sandy, which is easily disturbed and hard to stop once erosion starts. The best recommendation was an offshore breakwater system with minimum hardening to the toe, and Mrs. Field agreed. A motion was made that the application be approved with the condition that a water quality impact assessment be approved by the county. The motion failed by a 2-4 vote. It should be noted that only 120 foot long by 4 foot wide area falls within the Wetlands Board's jurisdiction. The majority of the project is landward of the board's jurisdiction, and that's why the water quality impact assessment was being required for the Chesapeake Bay Act. So basically, you're only looking at this portion that's within our jurisdiction, 4 feet off the bank here. All this is not in the Wetlands Board's jurisdiction. It's just this 4 feet here. Okay. A motion was made by Mr. Myers to change the project to a breakwater. This did not get a second, and the motion failed. The motion was then made by Mr. Myers to approve the application as presented with two modifications. One was to the heights of the stairs, or to stairs to be limited, and the other was a water quality impact assessment to be approved by the county. The motion carried 4-1 with one abstention. The motion was for the revetment was the same as recommended by the county staff in their report to the board. That ends the Woods portion of it. I'm going to go into the Morrison hearing. Again, 120 linear feet riprap, approximately 130 feet from the house. There's a growing here. This has been eliminated. VIMS recommended the removal of this, and the applicant agreed. So the growing is not in play. Cross-section, basically the same. Growing's been eliminated. And this is an aerial, a ground shot looking south towards Morrison's property. Again, the hearing was held on February 21st. Mrs. Morrison was represented by her agent and contractor, Steve Bunce. During the hearing, the board considered the VIMS report, county staff report and recommendation, and testimony provided by Mr. Bunce, Mrs. Morris, and Mr. and Mrs. Lindemann spoke in opposition. Both the VIMS report and the county staff recommendations were the same as stated in the Woods report. Mrs. Lindemann has concerns that the existing riprap on the nearby lots are adversely affecting her property and that the riprap covers the beach area. She asked the board not to approve projects which are ineffective. Mr. Lieben stated that the washout damage occurring to their property is very apparent. The board felt that had the first riprap structure not been constructed along this reach, the board may have asked the property owners for a comprehensive erosion control plan for the entire reach. Part of what's happened here is the first 600 linear feet of riprap was placed landward of the Wetlands Board's jurisdiction, so they didn't even have to issue a permit. They've only issued permits on one, possibly two riprap structures that were adjacent and south of the original 600 linear feet. Ms. Morrison stated that she did extensive research to save the bluff on her property, that she had revegetated the upland, but this past year erosion had occurred during storm events. The board asked Ms. Morrison if she would consider an offshore breakwater. She replied that she was open to talking to her adjacent property owners in the subdivision to see if anybody was willing to take part in the project. Mr. Bunce, who is the contractor, stated in his opinion that the riprap in the area is holding the bank rather well. Although erosion has not been completely stopped at the top of the bank, the riprap revetment would help shore up the bank if installed properly. And he also notes that there's been about 3 feet of erosion in the past month. There was a tree that was in this picture, which was taken 2 months ago, that in the aerials that you were shown earlier is down on the beach now. So 3 feet may be about right. Mrs. Lindemann then asked the board to deny both the Woods and Morrison application, and they would join with those two applicants in implementing an offshore breakwater. The board stated that even if the proposed revetment was approved, that did not preclude further breakwater projects from being implemented. The board stated that this application was basically the same as the Woods, which was just approved. A motion was made by Ms. Ellis to approve the application as presented with two modifications, removal of the growing and a water quality impact assessment be obtained. The motion carried 4-2. The motion, again, was for the revetment was the same as recommended by the county staff in their report to the board. I'll leave this one slide up as we go to lights. I'll leave this up. And my summary recommendation is for both the Woods and the Morrisons. Although the board has concerns that the projects may cause some additional erosion to the adjacent property, the board felt that the erosion rate along this reach was severe and that the revetment was necessary to protect the applicant's property from further erosion. The board noted that they have already approved riprap revetments adjacent to the project and did not feel they could require the applicants to install offshore breakwaters. They also questioned the reliability and cost of a small-scale breakwater system to protect one or two lots. Based on our review of the records transmitted by the board and our attendance at the hearings, staff believes that the decision to approve the riprap revetments for the subject applications are supported by the evidence on the whole, considered as a whole, In reaching its decision to approve the revetment, the board weighed the potential for public and private detriment against the potential for private benefits as required in the Code of Virginia. The board found the on-site erosion warranted protection of the applicant's property. Staff agrees with them that the preferred approach to shoreline protection along with this shoreline is to enhance the natural capacity of the sand flat with an offshore breakwater system. However, staff is reluctant to recommend against the proposed stone riprap revetment given the on-site erosion and the fact that there's over 800 linear feet of stone riprap already in place and that the subdivision as a whole is without a community association to address many offshore protection system options. At this time, an offshore breakwater system appears impractical on an individual lot-by-lot basis. Accordingly, we recommend that the February 21, 2007 decision of the Northampton County Wetlands Board be upheld for both the Woods and the Morrisons. Staff would further encourage that the applicants work with the remaining property owners to develop a comprehensive erosion control plan, which would address the entire reach of shoreline. Hopefully, this would include a properly designed breakwater system for the area.
Thank you, Hank. Anybody have any questions for Mr. Badger? Thank you, sir. Okay. Lindeman's here. Come forward, please, ma'am. Good afternoon. Raise your right hand. You solemnly swear the testimony that you're about to give will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God.
I do.
You state your name for the record, please.
Michelle Lindeman.
Proceed, please, ma'am.
I brought some pictures, additional pictures. I don't have a PowerPoint, but I thought perhaps when I read my statement you could look at them, or is that not allowed?
At this point, okay. That would require an opening of the record.
Well, I can hold them.
No, that would be the same. La.
I didn't bring anything, but just that.
Is the record opening just going to be those pictures, basically?
That's no, I have a statement.
Well, you can make the statement, I would presume. I have a motion to open the record.
So moved.
Motion by Mr. Tankard, second. Second by Mr. Fox. Any further discussion? All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Proceed.
Okay, would you like to look at them while I speak? Save some time?
Sure.
Okay.
And we will be keeping these for a period of 33 days, too, in case.
Once again, I am Michelle Lindeman, my husband, Henry Lindeman, and I, as the petitioners, would like to thank you for granting us a review of the February 21st, 2007 decision of the Northampton County Wetlands and Dunes Board on both VMRC 07196 and 0197. We stand here because we feel that our local program development, as defined by the Chesapeake Bay Preservation Area Designation and Management Regulations, has failed in their decision to uphold the regulations of the Bay Act by granting the Woods and Morrison permission to install riprap revetment in a resource protection area, also defined by the Chesapeake Bay Preservation Act and found in Chapter 21 of Title 10.1 of the Code of Virginia. The Wetlands Board, by failing to preserve the natural condition of the sensitive bluff in its full length and entirety, has also failed us as landowners of a tidal shoreline on Chesapeake Bay. In the granting of construction of a riprap revetment, a man-made disaster, the Wetlands Board has, in essence, turned the Bay Act in upon itself by interpreting its intent to be the protection of man against the bay rather than its true intent, the protection of bay from man. I take the liberty of paraphrasing Chapter 21 of Title 10.1. The purpose of the Chesapeake Bay Act regulation is to protect and improve the water quality of the bay by minimizing the effects of human activity upon these waters and to protect the waters from significant degradation due to land disturbances. Local programs shall encourage and promote protection of existing high-quality state waters to a condition that will permit all reasonable public uses, will support the propagation and growth of all aquatic life, and will safeguard the clean waters from pollution. The definition for the resource protection area states that these areas in their natural condition provide for the removal, reduction, or assimilation of sediments, nutrients, and potentially harmful or toxic substances and runoff entering the bay. And the general performance criteria for land use and development of these resource protection areas, our bluff, our mutual bluff, and its tidal shoreline are, one, no more land should be disturbed than is necessary to provide for the desired use or development. Two, indigenous vegetation shall be preserved to the maximum extent. Three, utilize best management practices require regular or periodic maintenance in order to continue their function and shall maintenance and such maintenance shall be ensured by the local government. You can see from my pictures, a lot of the boulders are falling and there is silt fence exposed. I feel it's not being enforced. Review of the Bay Act poses, in summary, more questions than suggestions, my first being one. What desired use is so supreme as to permit the intentional degradation of a naturally sloped buffer? That's protecting the bay as it is. Two, what use is so supreme as to grant permission to plow down a 20-foot bayside bluff that now slopes to Highway 13 and grade it so that it will slope the complete opposite direction, and that's right into the bay? Three, what use is so supreme to remove all the indigenous vegetation and disturb much more land as necessary, then install rocks and silt fences that are not maintained, thereby washing away all sand at the toe of a bluff? Four, what use is there for inadequate-sized rocks that roll around in state waters? Five, what use is there for plastic underlayment that does not hold sand or vegetation, then because exposed and less jettison and plastic bags and bottles and fishing line and balloons and every other manner of debris get caught and left in the rocks? Who should be responsible for cleaning this supreme use? Is the supreme use really going to prevent Mother Nature from doing what she has always done, claim what is hers? As I say, all this in the guise of preventing erosion, what erosion? The erosion that the northern neighbor caused your property when he put in his riprap embankment. This erosion has been occurring forever. They've just accelerated it by developing. The existing bluff in its natural state upholds the intent of the law of the Chesapeake Bay Act. Not only is the manner in which the existing riprap at Latimer's Bluff been installed and maintained contrary to the Bay Act, it also endangers the public, the aquatic animals that live at the tidal shoreline, and attracts and holds debris. What guarantees do we have that any other means of riprap will be better, or should I say serve the bay better? Is there not a healthier erosion control program that would also serve the Bay Act, the public, and the fisheries? The other landowners who appreciate and value the laws of nature and build their lives and homes around nature, not try to change it for their benefit. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions from Ms. Lindemann? Thank you, ma'am. Is anyone here from the Wetlands Board like to speak?
Yeah.
The applicant. Come forward.
Good afternoon. How are you? I'm Rita Woods.
Yes, ma'am. You raise your right hand. You solemnly swear the testimony that you're about to give will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, self you got.
I did.
Go ahead.
So I'll try and be brief.
Thank
I'm
you.
Sure this board is ready to
we
move on.
We are very
on.
Much impressed by brevity.
Good. Then that's what I'll be. In a nutshell, I ask that the Marine Resource Commission support its staff recommendations as well as the decision made by the Wetlands Commission to approve our application. Our application was based on already existing applications that had been approved for previous riprap that Mr. Badger has already shown today. The Wetlands Board was very thorough in their investigative process. They visited our site prior to the meeting. They discussed with us the timetables in which other neighbors had done their properties, et cetera, and I believe they took all of the necessary facts into account when they made their decision. They're in the positions they are because of knowledge they have in being able to make decisions that do support what they stand for and represent for the state. They were vocal about their preferences regarding the breakwaters, and we absolutely did recognize that. However, at this juncture, where time is of the essence, to do something actively about this beautiful piece of property, we need to do something that will be able to immediately address the concerns that we have on the top of the bank, which I understand is not part of this commission's or the wetlands process. However, what ties into that is that toe of the slope, which is essential in being very stable in order for that grading of the buff of the bluff to remain intact. So that the two absolutely do tie in. As far as the decision that they made that day, we do ask that you support that decision, that it not be sent back to the Wetlands Board. We have the stone in place, the contractor in place. Our timetables are such that for the growing season of any, for revegetation, that sort of thing, we've addressed all of this in these timetables. So if we end up getting into a situation where things have to be revisited by a board or a commission that's already agreed to do this and approves the process and the project, it seems like a waste of your time, their time, our time, taxpaying dollars' time. I appreciate what Mrs. Lindemann's concerns are. However, those are maybe concerns that she needs to address in a different manner. It's not for me to say. But I thank you, and if there are any further pictures that you need, I did come with photos. I don't need to, expend more of your time. They're primarily northbound photos showing that existing riprap that exists for the 700 to 800 feet that Mr. Badger mentioned, as well as some of the southbound photos, which I presume that's possibly what Mrs. Lindemann submitted to you, which is just supporting that there is erosion occurring, and we would like to do as our northbound neighbors did and try and protect our investment in that erosion.
Thank you, ma'am. Any questions from Ms. Lindemann?
Woods.
I'm sorry, Woods.
That's okay.
Long day already.
Yeah.
Ms. Woods. Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you.
Any other applicants here like to speak? I presume that would
okay.
be right. Can you raise your right hand for me, please? You solemnly swear the testimony that you're about to give will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God.
I do.
State your full name and for the record, please.
My name is Allison E. Morrison, and I am the property owner as pictured there, and I'm going to be brief, too, since it's been a long morning already. We applied for a permit because of the appreciable loss of land that was measured in excess of 6 feet since the fall. The indigenous vegetation that we put in 2 years ago is not being upheld. We've had a mudslide effect due to the rain. Sediment and runoff continues to go into the bay. We've noticed and observed that during the process when we put our permit in, that the southern coastline is not protected by riprap and has been severely impacted. We did attend the hearing in Eastville on February 21st, as Mr. Badger pointed out, and we did receive approval to proceed with our project. Due to the objections of the southern property owner, the Lindemans, we did investigate alternative methods for erosion control. After extensive research and contact with several other companies to explore the bladder concept with PVC being inflated, the balloon, it was determined that not only was it excessively expensive, but that it was not considered to be as effective and that there were potential problems with it breaking and then leaking sand out and then basically getting back to square one. We also did contact, I took it upon myself to contact the other property owners at Latimer's Bluff to ask them whether they would consider participating in a breakwater concept. With the support from the other homeowners, I did talk to Bill Sorrentino, who is in the Army Corps of Engineers, who has agreed to send an engineer out to do an analysis of that coastline to determine whether the breakwater concept would be effective. We're waiting for information back from him on that. In the event that he says that it's favorable from his reports, then we expect to get a coalition together to investigate the concept of riprap. I have no problem with putting the riprap in, neither do several of the property owners. That opportunity has been presented to the Lindemans. I've contacted them on a number of occasions, presented the information that I've received to them. At this juncture, they have not stepped forward to either participate in a riprap, other erosion control, or talk about the breakwater concept and wanting to participate in that. At this point, I'm going to reiterate what the Woods have said. The stone's ordered. The stone is in place. It's ready to be delivered. We want to get the project moving because looking at the degradation of the pluff, the sediment runoff that continues, the impact from our particular steps being part of them washed away from the mudslide, that we feel that it is in our best interest to protect the inherent land as well as prevent further runoff. So I have pictures also pretty much similar to show the degradation of the bluff. We're asking for a decision to be made as soon as possible so we can proceed with our project and get this taken care of.
Thank you. Any questions?
You.
Thank you, ma'am. Any other applicant or relation agent? And we'll hear from the board, Wetlands Board.
I'm just here for questions.
Okay, good enough. Thank you, sir. Anybody have any questions for representative of the Wetlands Board? If not, the matter is before the commission for discussion and decision. Mr. Holland.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we accept the recommendation of the staff.
Second.
Seconded by Mr. Robbins.
I have a question for counsel, please. Ms. Lindemann mentioned the Chesapeake Bay Act. Does that have an application here, or is that something we need to pay attention to?
I'm not aware of any decision or opinion concerning the relationship between the Chesapeake Bay Preservation Act and the wetland statute, tidal wetland statute. But what I would point out that under the wetland statute, the standard for granting a permit, there's three factors there, and one is the anticipated public and private benefit exceeds anticipated public and private detriment. Two, it conforms with the code standards and wetlands guidelines. And three, it does not violate the purposes and intent of the tidal wetland statute. So, I mean, the General Assembly has said, here's, if it meets all of these things, you grant it. If it doesn't meet any of the, one of them, then you deny it. But that's, the General Assembly has given you the direction in how to decide these cases. That's for the lower board. I mean, that's for the wetlands board. Now, on appeal, you're deciding whether they conform with that.
Answer your question sufficiently, Mr. Ross? Further discussion? Mr. Taggart.
Yeah, I think you can also, when you look at 28.2-1403-10B1, yeah, the Lindemans definitely put forward in some fashion with the pictures they depict a beach that is no longer really natural but more industrial in nature. So I know that we're taking, in some respect, value away from the Lindemans by continuing on the path of that we have with the riprap, but at the same time, that has course has been pursued already. I feel as though the Wetlands Board from Eastville has done a good job, so I plan to vote with the motion. As it, but at the same time, I perfectly well understand and sympathize with the plight of the Lindemans. The natural landscape that you see there is, I think, both good for the Lindemans and good for the Eastern Shore of Virginia. It's a much more pleasant landscape. So I just want to put that forward that it is. I'm saddened that we have to make this kind of choice.
Yeah. I have a sneaking suspicion the way it sounded like things were going that ultimately they may resort to the different type of erosion control, and hopefully that will work out. But at the, in the interim, I concur with you all. I believe that the board in reaching its decision to approve the revetment weighed the potential for public and private detriments against the potential for private benefits as required by the Code of Virginia, and the finding that on-site erosion warranted protection of the applicant's property. All in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Any opposed? Motion carries unanimously. Thank you very much. Next item on the agenda is Marine Hydraulics 04-1984. Hello, Elizabeth.
Before I begin, we received an additional protest this morning that you all don't have.
Thank you, ma'am.
All right, Marine Hydraulics Incorporated requests modification of their previously issued permit to include dredging using either clamshell or hydraulic methods of 5,400 cubic yards of stated and submerged lands within a 130-foot by 140-foot basin to create maximum depths of minus 10 feet below mean low water at their property situated along the Elizabeth River in Norfolk. The project is protested by nearby property owners. Kathy, can I play? This project is located on the eastern shoreline of the Elizabeth River, immediately adjacent to the Lambert's Point Marine Terminal Facility. This section of shoreline is industrial, and the Midtown Tunnel is located approximately 1,000 feet southeast of the project site. So 2002 aerial and a more recent aerial view. Ground shot. This modification request is for the additional dredging of 5,400 cubic yards of state-owned submerged lands within a 130-foot by 140-foot basin. And you can see that circled in red. It's in front of their previously approved bulkhead. This basin is to moor Navy barges for temporary crew housing while a ship is undergoing repair. Side view. On February 28, 2006, the Commission approved MHI's request to install a trestle to support a mobile crane, three mooring dolphins, dredge 491,000 cubic yards for the installation of a dry dock and also an associated access channel to connect with the Federal Navigation Channel, construct a 193-foot bulkhead with associated fill, and install a 26-foot long by 24-foot wide bridge to access the dry dock. Since that request was approved last year, MHI has decided to use a smaller dry dock and has modified their original request to reduce the dredge footprint to 113,600 cubic yards, install two dolphins, and still construct 193-foot bulkhead with associated fill, as well as dredge this additional area. The City of Norfolk Wetlands Board approved the dredging of 700 square feet of non-vegetated wetlands in front of the bulkhead on November 8, 2006. By emails dated February 26, 2007, and March 16, 2007, several residents of the Westgate neighborhood stated their objections to the project. They note that they objected to the previous project, and they oppose any increase in dredging. It appears that their main concern is the potential for the amount of truck and pedestrian traffic to increase as a result of the additional dredging. Given the industrial nature of the shoreline, and since the objections to the project seem to focus primarily on upland issues outside the jurisdiction of the Commission, staff recommends approval of the project as proposed with the following conditions. Staff recommends that a pre-dredging conference be required and that the applicant be required to submit a post-dredging bathymetric survey of the dredged area within 30 days of completion of the dredging so staff may assess permit compliance. Staff also recommends the assessment of a royalty in the amount of $2,430 for the dredging of 5,400 cubic yards at a rate of 45 cents per cubic yard. Any questions?
Any questions for Elizabeth? Mr. Fox.
The letters that you just gave us mentioned something about, and I just scanned them quickly, some fear that there may be dredging of wetlands, but there's no dredging of wetlands contemplated in this proposal.
If you look right in there, 700 mm-hmm. square feet of non-vegetated wetlands, and that was approved by the Wetlands Board on November 8th, 2006.
Okay, so there is some dredging in wetlands.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's already been approved.
Right, 100 square feet, say, or something.
700.
Oh, 700 square feet.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you, ma'am. Is the applicant here or represented? Good afternoon, sir.
Good afternoon.
How are you? You solemnly swear the testimony you're about to give will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God.
I do.
For the record, please state your name, sir.
My name's Tom Langley with Langley & McDonald Engineers in Virginia Beach.
Always a pleasure.
Mr. Commissioner and members of the Commission, appreciate the opportunity. I'll try to be as brief as I possibly can. Mr. Fox, you asked about the 700 square feet of non-vegetated wetlands. This project has been going through several permit phases over the last several years. And there is a mitigation site on the eastern branch of the Elizabeth River that compensates for wetlands on this project. We tried to mitigate wetlands here twice. The geese ate it all up and put monofilament out there, tried to keep everything as safe as we could, and we were unsuccessful with that, and it's just too much of an exposed site. So as part of this project, we moved it to the eastern branch on their property there, and to the best of my knowledge, that mitigation has gone very well. Beyond that, I think Ms. Gallup presented the project very well, and the applicant is here in case there are any questions that I can't answer, but otherwise I'll leave it at that.
Any questions of Mr. Langley? Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Tom, did the applicant didn't want to speak unless there are any questions? Is that correct? Okay. Is anyone here in opposition to the project? Anyone here in opposition? Matters before the commission. Mr. Holland.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we accept staff recommendation.
Mr. McCluskey.
I second it.
Motion made by Mr. Holland, seconded by Mr. McCluskey. Further discussion. Mr. Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just reviewing this letter of protest, it does seem that a number of the issues raised in protest include upland issues that are outside of our jurisdiction. And in considering that, I think we rely in part on the official opinion of the Attorney General that says that the commission should consider the effect on adjacent or nearby properties generally to be direct physical impacts on the adjacent nearby properties, as well as our precedent for handling upland issues. So with that, I think staff's recommendation is sound and consistent with code, and I'm going to support the motion.
I think that's an excellent point. Further discussion? All in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Motion carries unanimously. Thank you very much. Next item is Valiant Ventures, permit number 061022. Elizabeth.
Please, Kathy. Valiant Ventures requests authorization to construct a 150-foot long by 6-foot wide community pier with a 6-foot by 128-foot T-head platform with 5 32-foot long by 4-foot wide finger piers with 10 boat slips with lifts for a future condominium association adjacent to properties situated along the eastern branch of the Elizabeth River in Norfolk. The proposed community pier is designed to serve a new 9-lot residential subdivision to be known as Elizabeth River Point at the end of Shorewood Lane in Norfolk. This property is located on the eastern branch of the Elizabeth River in Norfolk to the west of the Military Highway Bridge. This section of the Elizabeth is primarily residential. The property with the arrow. According to the application drawings, only lot numbers number 5, 6, and 7 of the 9 lots of riparian properties. If the community pier is approved as proposed, the applicant has agreed to sever the riparian rights of the 3 riparian waterfront properties. The community pier will be the only structure providing water access to property owners within the new subdivision. This is side view shot. This is a ground view shot taken from the Military Highway Bridge. The Virginia Department of Health, Division of Wastewater Engineering, approved an alternate pump-out agreement between Elizabeth River Point and Tidewater Yacht on February 21st of this year. DEQ commented that water quality impacts will be minimal, and therefore Virginia Water Protection Permit is not required, and the Coast Guard did not have any objections. The applicant was advised that the number of slips that staff could support for the community was 7, based on the number of riparian waterfront properties. That's 2 per waterfront lot plus 1 community slip. The applicant insists that he needs at least 9 slips and would prefer 10 since there are 9 lots in the subdivision. Staff generally supports the community pier approach to provide a central point of water access for communities with riparian properties. One community pier is typically recommended over numerous individual private piers given the cumulative environmental and aesthetic impacts involved. In this instance, staff recommends approval of the community pier. However, staff can only support a maximum number of 7 boat slips, given that there are only 3 riparian waterfront properties in the subdivision. That would also be conditioned on deed restrictions, which prohibit the construction of individual private piers. Should the commission decide to approve the community pier in some form, staff recommends assessing a royalty based on the total square footage of the bold outline footprint encompassing the pier, slips, and any other approved appurtenances at a rate of $1.50 per square foot. Any questions?
Any questions for Ms. Gallup? Thank you, Elizabeth. Is the applicant here or represented? Good afternoon, sir.
Do you want to put your PowerPoint on?
Yeah, please.
Raise your right hand. You solemnly swear the testimony that you're about to give will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God.
I do.
You state your name for the record, please.
My name is Robert Cinelli. I am the managing member for Valiant Ventures.
Good to have you here, sir.
Thank you, sir. I have a couple other illustrations, but perhaps I don't know what the protocol is, but I can just set them up here and look at them.
Yes, sir. That'd be fine.
This is a photograph of the subject property. This is a photograph of the subject property taken in the early 90s. As you can see, here's the bridge that Elizabeth was referring to. This is a property right next door that's recently been in the middle of a subdivision. They're put a road in. They're building homes, and they're in the process of building their community pier as well. Our property is here. The subdivision, as you can see, consists of 9 lots, 3 lots with riparian rights, and here's our boat slip and marina facility coming off between lots 5 and 6. I took a few photographs just to show you, further illustrate. How do I work this?
You just want to hit the down arrow.
Okay, good. Again, here's an overview of the project. This is going to be a very upscale community on the river. Price ranges of the homes are really going to be starting from the high 500s to low 600s and up. Currently, construction is taking. Here's a photograph of the entrance into the adjacent property, which is Shorewood Shores, which is again under. They're having a pier being constructed as we speak. That's their home. That's on the market for sale. And here's our street coming down straight to the Elizabeth. Home number 1, which is a little dark shot here, but that's, in the process of being built. These are just pictures of the adjacent lots, lots 2 and 3. And these are lots 7 and 8 on the west side of the street. Here's lot 5. And you can see an old existing pier in the background. That'll also be removed during construction. Here's lot 6. And here's the proposed path that'll lead you to the pier. And the pier will go over the riprap, which we have an outfall there. It'll go out approximately 150 feet. Again, there's a picture of the pier that's existing that's going to be removed. On the right side of the property, there's an old piece left over from God knows when, but that's going to be removed and that piling out in the end. As you can see in the background, those are the piles going in for the pier next door. And that's it. So my request is that the board consider at least a minimum of a 9-slip subdivision, of a 9-slip facility, given the fact that there's a community going right next door, the marketability would make it very difficult, What do I do with the 2 lots that don't have slip access? It would just be a real difficult situation for us to work with. And I ask for your consideration for a minimum of 9 slips. Like to have a 10th one for guest availability, but at least a minimum of 9 is what we would prefer.
Can you let that look right up again, please? Thank you, sir. Anyone have any questions? Mr. Packard.
Yes, sir. Would you hold that up again? Your lot, you have 3 riparian lots you mentioned. Would you point them out to me so that I'm clear?
Okay. This is lot 5, lot 6, and lot 7. The little canal that comes in here. Again, right next door, it's going to be a 9-lot subdivision with 9 boat slips. It would be odd if there's another 9-home subdivision with only 7 slips. So to me, it just doesn't.
So, Elizabeth, can you address that comment, please?
The one next door was Mr. Bymiller, and I believe he came before the commission September of 2006. And it was an after-the-fact community pier permit. They constructed it with 11, and there were 4 waterfront properties, 4 riparian properties. And so they had to remove 2. So then they had 9, which is 4 lots times 2 plus 1.
I would ask one other thing. I mean, in terms of the the formula, I mean, why couldn't there just easily be allowance of two slips for each riparian lot and one guest slip for each riparian lot, and that would be equivalent to nine? I mean, I just don't understand why one guest slip for three lots. I don't know how that comes from.
Well, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, if you're a riparian owner, mm-hmm. then you have an enjoyment to wharf out under public trust doctrine and some other things. Mm-hmm. If you're an inland property owner, it's not a recognized right that you have the right to wharf out. And I think probably staff, in coming to conclusion, we're trying to protect the waterways, and we have problems with storms and debris and things breaking up. And so I think that's the rationale that's normally used, but it has been flexible at times, and that's why we have the commission here. So that's, but I think that pretty much adequately answers the question.
Thank you.
Mr. Schick.
Yeah, these waterfront lots, are they the smallest possible lots, or could you break one of them up into?
No, this has already been approved long ago by Planning Commission in Norfolk, and it's just the way it laid out.
Yeah. But would it be possible to subdivide any of those?
No, it wouldn't, because you got to have a minimum of 100-foot
right.
frontage.
Okay. Okay.
Further questions? Thank you, sir.
Mr.
Holland?
One question. On the subdivision next door, mm-hmm. Refresh my memory on what happened on that. They put in 11 slips.
Yeah, you know, I don't have the pier. This is a picture from that presentation. They had put a community pier right in this area, and they had 11 slips.
Mm-hmm.
But
actually, it's in the center.
Is it in the center? Okay, I'm sorry.
Between
it's right in here. Okay. Yeah. And they only had four waterfront properties. So four times two slips plus one guest slip is nine. And so the commission voted to allow them to keep nine but remove two of the already constructed slips.
Okay. So they had to remove two slips.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
They have seven total lots.
Nine total. 11.
But four waterfront.
No, it's nine. That's right.
There's nine lots there with nine boat slips.
It looks like, yeah, it looks like there's nine lots. But the reason there's nine boat slips is four waterfront
right,
lots.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Further questions? Is anyone here, any else that wants to speak in support of this application? Anyone here in opposition to this application?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Sir. Solemnly swear the testimony that you're about to give will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
Yes, I do.
Thank you. State your name.
My name is Ellis W. James. I reside at 2021 Kenlake Place in the city of Norfolk. This particular project is, and the questions that you commissioners have just asked, I'm encouraged by. This is a classic example of how we're losing our water edges, and we are furthering the question of loss of quality of water in the Elizabeth River. I would hope that the commission would support the staff recommendation, if at the very least. We're in a situation in this particular location where the battle between the developers and the question of whether or not this project is upscale or otherwise is not the issue. The issue is protection of the water edges and the quality of water. And I would hope that the commission would go to the low end of what you allow as opposed to going to the requested upper end. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. James? Thank you, sir. Anyone else in opposition? Matters before the commission for discussion and decision. Mr. Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think the formula and analysis that staff's proposing to apply in this case is reasonable. From a policy consistency standpoint, it's also consistent with what was done next door. And I think it's important that the applicant has offered to restrict the deeds on the riparian lots and take the community peer approach. I think it's good, but I think it should be limited in scale as was done next door. And I would offer a motion that we accept staff's recommendation with those conditions.
A question from council.
I would note that according to the staff presentation, the agreement to put the deed restrictions only were applied if the project were approved as requested. I don't know that that would apply if he only got 9 slips.
I don't know if that's the intent. Mr. Graham.
That was the intent.
Okay.
If the result is then that lots 5, 6, and 7 can have their own community, or their own private pier based on the exemption provided in code, then staff doesn't support a community pier for access from the walkway that was shown. We would only support a single pier with 7 slips based on the staff formula predicated on deed restrictions prohibiting other private piers.
Well, that's how the presentation.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's proposed.
Okay. In that case, I'd like to make a substitute motion if I could.
Well, I think the applicant might be willing to agree. He's been shaking his head there.
Come forward. Question for you from our counsel.
Would you still be willing to sever the riparian rights for the waterfront lots if you only get 7 slips?
That's the problem. It really puts a hardship on us if we can only market 7 slips with 9 lots. I mean, which lots don't get boat slips? I mean, it creates havoc for the whole homeowners association. You know, in the fact that you have 9 homes, it just makes it really complicated. So, I honestly don't know what I'll do with the project if I can't get 9 slips approved. I mean, from a marketability standpoint, how do you deal with that? I don't even know. I mean, and then for two homeowners don't have access to the pier, and are they part of the homeowners association? Those are questions that my council has proposed to me. How are you going to deal with that? I said, well, I don't know. We'll hopefully get 9 approved.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Robbins first.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I'm concerned about the consistency of policy. I mean, what staff's recommendation is basically what was done next door in terms of two boat slips on the community pier per riparian lot plus 1 guest slip, and that's exactly what they're recommending. Additionally, as I read the summary recommendation section, it says, in this instance, staff recommends approval of the community pier. However, staff can only support a maximum number of 7 boat slips, given that there are only 3 riparian waterfront properties in the subdivision. That would also be conditioned on deed restrictions which prohibit the construction of individual private piers. If we're not going to have deed restrictions in this case, I don't think I would support any boat slips on the community pier.
Who have deed restrictions?
Which prohibit the construction of individual private piers.
I had a substitute motion. Should have gone to him before. Go ahead, Mr. Schick.
In light that the applicant doesn't seem to be willing to go to the recommendations of staff, substitute motion is to deny the application. Now, of course, if the applicant was willing to agree to staff's recommendation, then I would withdraw my substitute motion.
I have a question for counsel. Mr. Chairman, I have a question. Question for counsel, and that is if we approve the motion as passed, and the deed restrictions prohibiting the construction of individual private piers are a condition of the permit, then would it not be the case that they can't proceed with construction? The
permit would not be issued until such time as a deed restrictions, but the gentleman, as I understand, has stated that he would not, or doesn't know, but it probably would not put in place the deed restrictions on.
Can they come up and clarify this again one time?
Yes, sir.
The deed restrictions have been prepared. They have not been. I sent a copy of the deed restrictions to Tracy West when she was here, and the deed restrictions clearly have been written to preclude any of the riparian lot owners from building their own individual pier as long as there's a 9 slip pier built for the community. The issue is, yes, the deed restrictions will be written and have been written to restrict the riparian lot owners from building their own pier, provided there's a community pier with 9 slips. If I only can get 7 slips, then probably, we'll let the 3 other riparian lot, I'll probably scrap the whole pier concept,
and let the three riparian lot owners build whatever they're going to build when they buy. But I thought it would be a lot better for the whole community and the whole waterway to have one central pier for all the lot owners. And you know, like I say, right next door, there's, again, you're right, there's apparently four riparian lots next door, although one of them is touching it. Really, you know, two more slips for our project, I don't really see where it's provides a big impact to the waterway there. It doesn't really take on that much space.
All right. That's fine. Now, what
I have a question.
Okay.
On the homes that don't have a slip, how much do you think that depreciates the value? And matter of how much is slips worth?
Well, I think the slip is probably worth $15,000 to $20,000 per lot, but it's not so much the value. It's just given the opportunity. You know, there's not much waterfront property left. This is an upscale street, upscale community. You know, giving the right for people that can't afford to live on the water, but have their own boat and be able to walk to their boat, to me, I think is something we should have more of.
All right. Thank you.
All right.
Now, let me make sure to get back on track. Mr. Robbins, you've made a motion, and that motion, if you, to your motion, condition the deed restrictions, that takes care of the issue at that point, because he can either
take it or leave it.
Right. That's correct. And that is what is on the, as I understand, does that make sense to you, Mr. Schick?
He meant substitute.
My substitute motion was, instead of leaving a permit hanging out to whether it's going to happen or not, I'm saying he's already made the decision, and let's go ahead and decline it. And if he wants to do something in the future, he can bring it before us.
Substitute motion is on the floor by Mr. Schick to deny the application. Is there a second?
Yeah.
Seconded by?
My thinking is community peers, more than not, don't have enough slips for its development. It's very common, mm-hmm. and it's just a first-come, first-served situation. You have seven slips. The first seven that want to buy them, get them. So
the way this was designed, sir, is that these slips were not going to be for sale. They were going to go with each lot. Each homeowner was going to get a boat slip, and so, you know, it wasn't going to be a deeded sort of thing, but basically the homeowners association that's been formed will own the pier, and each homeowner will be a one-ninth owner of the homeowners association. So that's how it was designed.
Okay. Motion made by Mr. Schick to deny, second by Mr. Holland. Further discussion? Mr. Robbins and Mr. Tankard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to respectfully vote against it and stick with the original motion, simply because I think the original motion is something that the developer can take or leave. It'll be up to him to decide whether he wants to have two lots or six lots that don't have any riparian access in his own calculations. And I think the community approach is a good one, but I think it is necessary to sever the riparian rights. There is no right to wharf out of an interior lot owner. I think a community pier, while some people may be able to tie a boat up at it, much of the enjoyment of a community pier is simply being able to go out and walk out on the pier with your family or however you choose to enjoy it. We do that in our neighborhood on a regular basis. So,
okay. I understand. Mr. Tanker, did you have a comment?
Yeah, I just wanted to also say that I think I'm going to vote against the motion as well, for the simple fact that this is the best deal in my mind. The third lot over there is going into a canal / ditch. I mean,
that's a different. That's a different development. That's a property next.
No. Excuse me. The third lot.
I'm sorry. Yeah.
So yes, he could have three piers.
When you pointed that way, I thought.
Excuse me. Yes. But this is, as I see, the best deal going for everybody concerned. So I'd like to keep this alive.
Okay. All in favor of Mr. Schick's motion to deny, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
That's, raise your hand. That's two. All opposed? The original motion is now to accept staff recommendations with the condition, as I understand, of deed restrictions being in place to allow the seven. Is that correct, Mr. Robbins?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman.
Who seconded the motion?
And the royalties.
And the royalties. Who seconded the motion, the original motion?
Nobody did.
Nobody did. Can I get a second? Second by Mr. Tankard. Further discussion? All in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed?
No.
Yeah.
Two noes. Motion carries. Thank you very much.
Next item on the agenda is Margaret Blevins, 07-0139. Both wetlands and subaqueous permits are required.
Commissioner, members of the commission, I hope this is quite a bit shorter than my last time here before you.
No comment.
This application by Mrs. Blevins requests authorization to install 205 linear feet of timber bulkhead flanked at the property line with riprap protection and to install three low-profile timber groins extending 48 feet channelward to mean high water adjacent to her property situated along Portobago Bay in Caroline County, and both wetlands and subaqueous permits are required by the commission since Caroline County has not yet adopted the wetland zoning ordinance. As we've often found in Caroline County, I've been here in front of the commission several times recently. Most of the projects have been on Portobago Bay or nearby, in the Portobago Bay subdivision. This is the location here. And unfortunately, this photo is at a time when her property had not been developed, but a general location here. These properties do have banks that are approximately 25 feet high and do have a shoreline in front of the bank that is upwards of 30 feet in width. The applicant is proposing to install 205 linear feet of timber bulkhead and three low-profile timber groins, as shown in this drawing here. For the most part, the bulkhead is actually above the mean high water line. This drawing actually shows that the entire structure is above mean high water. However, when VIMS made their site visit, they did determine that about 30 linear feet in the portion of the project here at this this inflection point in the bulkhead actually does extend approximately 5 feet channelward of mean high water, and actually, as you know, because of that, is impacting non-vegetated wetlands of approximately 75 square feet. So we will be taking jurisdiction over that portion of the project here today. The applicant is also requesting a private pier. However, staff has determined that that pier qualifies for statutory authorization and will not require a permit from the commission. Excuse me. This is just a cross section here showing where the bulkhead is in relation to the existing bank here, the dotted line, and how they'll be grading that back and backfilling it. Again, most of it is above high water. And just a cross section is showing the timber groins, just a typical design. And this is just a ground shot from the adjacent property owner's pier looking back up onto the Blevins' bank. Kathy, if I could have the lights, I'm sorry. Photo's a little washed out there. But you can see here the bank, it is experiencing some erosion at the bottom, as well as some sloughing at the top based upon the failure of some of the trees that are directly at the edge of the bank. Just another ground shot. This is on top of the bank looking east. Portobago Bay was frozen that day. This was 2 months ago here. Oops, I'm sorry. This is looking out on the adjacent property owner's steps going down to his pier, looking back up Mrs. Blevins' property. You can actually see there's a stake here that represents the alignment of the bulkhead, the start of the bulkhead, and it follows an alignment back through here and around her property. This is the portion of the project that VIMS did identify as being an impact area. You can see a stake right here. It's actually in the water here. This was not at a low tides, but it was, in their determination, channelward of mean high water. And so there is an approximately 75 square feet in this general area that is being impacted. And I have spoken with the applicant, their agent here, earlier today, and they seemed amendable possibly is to pull in that back to move it out of the commission's jurisdiction, but I'll let them speak to that when they get up here. Let me actually read to you what VIMS, a summarization of what they said. Their shoreline application report dated March 20, 2007 states that if an erosion control structure is permitted, that the use of a riprap revetment would be preferable because it provides habitat and dissipates wave energy. VIMS notes that the groin on an adjacent upstream property has successfully captured sand, but is concerned over the potential impact to the downstream property as a result of the installation of the proposed groins. They therefore recommend that if the groins are permitted, that they be artificially nourished with appropriate sand to lessen adverse impacts to adjacent shorelines. The report estimates that the proposed bulkhead, as I've mentioned, will result in the loss of 75 square feet of non-vegetated sand or mud flat mixed flat tidal wetlands, and that the proposed groins will result in the loss of 18 square feet of non-vegetated wetlands and 126 square feet of subaqueous bottom. We did receive comments from the Department of Game and Inland Fisheries. They actually have identified this area as an eagle concentration area and has confirmed an adramus fish use area. They have therefore recommended a time of year restriction which will preclude any construction activities between May 1st through September 30th and November 1st through February 28th to minimize adverse impacts upon eagles, and February 15th through June 30th to minimize potential adverse impacts upon anadromous fish. However, based upon the scope of the project, staff does not feel that it is necessary to include these time of year restrictions as a condition of the permit. DGIF further recommended that an alternative be considered to the bulkhead and groin design, such as a living shoreline treatment, as well as the implementation of erosion and sediment control measures, including the use of a turbidity curtain. We also received comments from the Department of Conservation and Recreation that has stated that a bald eagle nest has been documented in the area, but that the project would not impact any other areas within their jurisdiction. And no other state agency provided any comments, and we did not receive any comments from any individuals in opposition or in favor of the project. This is just that the previous slide that showed the stake in the water. This is looking from the opposite direction. Here again, you see that stake. And essentially what you have here is this is a marl that actually is acting as a small headland. So it's a little bit more erosion resistant. So the bank has eroded around the edge of it, and therefore the shoreline hasn't kept up in this area. So mean high water actually juts a little bit further out in this general location than it does along the rest of the shoreline. There's another stake here. You connect between the two of them. So the impact essentially is between here and here, and then this stake and another one on the other side. VIMS has stated to staff that if this particular stake here were pulled back approximately 5 feet, which would place it close to the base of this bank, that it would pull it above mean high water and outside the jurisdiction of the commission, outside of the wetlands jurisdiction. So that is something that the applicants could consider. This is just another drawing here looking at the bank. You can see she has several trees directly on the bank. This is one where it's still holding, and it's formed a little jut out in on the bank there. But that tree is unfortunately likely to go here soon if something doesn't happen, or may actually be removed during bank grading. This is the groin on the adjacent upstream property, and as you can see, it has captured quite a bit of sand. From a distance further down the east of the Blevins property, we could see some other groins that also seem to be working quite well. So staff feels fairly confident that her proposed groins will be successful, and that any impacts to the adjacent downstream property owner will be mitigated by the fact that that property owner is submitting almost a similar application using the same agent that will likely be before the commission here in the next month or two as soon as we receive that. Staff noted during its site visit that the groins on neighboring properties appear to be working well and have increased the width of the beach in those areas. It appears that Mrs. Blevins' proposed groins have been properly designed and may enhance her shoreline protection project. Staff is also aware that Mrs. Blevins' agent, as I just mentioned, Ms. Mary Perfides, is in the process of preparing an application of a similar design project for the downstream property, which should lessen any adverse impacts that were of concern by VIMS. Accordingly, since impacts resulting from the use of tidal wetlands and state-owned submerged land can be avoided or should be minimal, and after considering all of the factors contained in sections 28.2, 1205A, and 28.2, 1302 of the Code of Virginia, staff recommends that the three timber groins be approved as proposed, but that the proposed bulkhead be denied. However, staff would recommend the Commission consider allowing the applicant to install an appropriately designed riprap revetment constructed against the bank. In the alternative, the applicant may simply wish to realign the proposed bulkhead landward of mean high water and outside the Commission's jurisdiction. Staff would further recommend the Commission require the applicant to submit revised project drawings which accurately depict the current on-site conditions and the project as it is authorized. Staff would also like to note that we typically would recommend a royalty for the encroachment of timber groins over state-owned subaqueous bottom at a rate of 50 cents per square foot. However, the groins in this particular case were designed to meet the requirements of our VGP General Permit Number 2, which is intended for groins. And since royalties are not assessed for those general permits, staff does not recommend the assessment of a royalty for the encroachment of the three proposed groins in this case. If you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
Any questions have been Mr. Schick and then Mr. Robbins.
I got one question and a follow-up. Are you saying in your staff recommendations that they also artificially nourish these groins after construction?
Staff is not making that recommendation. VIMS typically does include that, but from you know what staff has seen, that we're not sure it's necessary to put that requirement on the Blevins at this time. The groins would qualify for the general permit. If we had a wetlands board in Caroline County, the wetlands board would have heard this issue, approved the project, and the commission in issuing the permit for the groins. We wouldn't have issued an individual permit. It would have been a general permit that simply, once they meet the requirements for it, as long as we don't have any major heartburn over it, it's typically issued to them. So for that reason, we have not recommended the nourishment.
My follow-up question is, are these groins necessary for stabilization or just to have the beach grow? I mean, that last one that we denied the groins. And, you know, I just know that, you know, you start getting groins all the way down
the last project,
you know, down the line.
The last project that we had in Caroline County that was for a Mr. Pullen, and let me pull up the map here just to show you where he is. The subdivision that Ms. Blevins lived is in this general vicinity here on Portobago Bay. Mr. Pullen actually lived up off of this road here in this general vicinity, actually on the Rappahannock River, slightly just above the Portobago Bay. The conditions there were slightly different, and we were concerned about the use of the groins in that area and the loss of sediment going to his downstream property owner. However, the bay is fairly protected, and we don't seem to think that there's quite as big of an issue in this general area. So,
Mr. Robbins?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The question I had related to one of your alternate recommendations of reorienting the bulkhead, if it were to be a timber bulkhead, landward of mean high water, and I think you said if it were shifted 5 feet.
5 feet. It's only a 30 linear foot section. That's a jurisdictional call for this commission. That the remaining is 205 total linear feet. They could build the rest of it without any authorization from the commission. It's just those 30 feet have an impact of 75 square foot, and it's one stake that VIMS felt if it was pulled back 5 feet, it would pull the bulkhead completely out of the commission's jurisdiction over tidal wetlands in this case, and that a permit would not be required. But because VIMS has recommended the use of riprap, staff has also taken that recommendation and provided that to you unless the applicant is willing to realign that above your jurisdiction.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I think we'll hear from the applicant on the realignment. Yeah. Sounds good. Any other questions? Thank you, Ben.
Sure.
Job well done. Is the applicant here or represented? Good afternoon, ma'am. Just raise your right hand. You solemnly swear the testimony that you're about to give will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God. You state your name, who you represent, please, ma'am.
I'm Mary DeCita. I'm the agent for Margaret Blevins.
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. and Mrs. Blevins are here today.
Okay.
But, I don't have anything to add.
Okay, first question. How about the realignment of the bulkhead? Is the applicant agreeable to?
Yes.
They are. Okay, that issue's off the table.
All I wanted to add was that neighbors do not object, property owners associated.
We'll take those if you'd like.
All right.
Any questions of the agent?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Mr. Shea?
Are the applicants open to the idea of using rock instead of more durable?
No, that was the first suggestion, and the neighbor to the north has a wood bulkhead. Two doors down is a wood bulkhead, and next door, the application's in process. Mm-hmm. They want to have them all wood bulkheads. They'll all tie into each other.
Further questions of the agent? Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you.
Anyone in opposition to this project? Matter is before the commission for discussion and action. Mr. Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Given the fact that the agent has expressed the willingness to realign the bulkhead, I would move that the project be approved with the stipulation that the bulkhead be realigned, landward of mean high water, and conditional on receipt of revised project drawings that are approved by staff.
Is there a second?
Question.
Question by Mr. Fox.
Do we even have to approve the bulkhead if they agree to move it 5 foot landward? We don't need to have it in the motion at all, do we?
That would be correct.
So would the maker of the motion accept a modification to just have the motion cover only the groin?
Yes, I would withdraw the motion and offer a motion that we approve the project groin.
Then do we have to deny the the applicant pulls out the bulkhead request, we have to either deny it. With the understanding that the applicant's
concerned. Yeah, we need to dispose of it some way so that it's not implied.
Well, one of the requirements was that the applicant provide revised drawings.
Right.
Given their willingness to move it back 5 feet, considering the fact that the non-vegetated wetlands are only to mean high, the bulkhead itself is landward of the commission's jurisdiction. Due to that change, it will not require commission action. There's no opposition to the groins. We could issue a VGP, but since it's based on a wetlands board action and acting as a wetlands board, you're not going to do anything. I would say the better course would be to approve the groins with nourishment, without nourishment. I mean, but just confine your decision to the
Groins.
To the groins.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I move to approve the groins.
Second.
I'd like to add, if the maker would do so, that that they would be required to nourish them. That's Vim's suggestion, and you know, wooden groins in themselves, you know, they do take away from other properties in general.
I would accept that amendment.
Okay, motion made by Mr. Robbins, seconded. Is there a second to the motion?
So moved.
Fox, I don't know. Fox asked a question. I don't know. Don't believe that he seconded it just a minute ago. Did you?
Pardon?
You didn't second that motion a little while ago. You had a question, correct?
I only had a question.
That's correct. Seconded by Mr. Tankard. Further discussion? All in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Motion carries unanimously. Thank you very much. Number 11, Shah Hemang and Apurva Patel. Mr. Stagg.
Yes, sir.
This is an after-the-fact approval request from Shah Hemang and Apurva Patel for approval of a previously constructed and unauthorized expansion of a T-head at the end of a pier. The T-head was authorized to be 10 feet by 20 feet and was constructed 20 feet by 21.5 feet. The project is actually located at those two addresses in Suffolk. the Sleepy Hole section along the Nansemon River, generally in this location. We originally received an application, an individual application from each one of the property owners for this pier. The adjoining property owner that's not shown here, Mr. Patel, also was asking for a bulkhead in his application. We wrote back to the agent and indicated that because this was going to be a shared-use pier, and basically this pier emanates from their shared property line, which is right here, which straddles the upland deck and then emanates from that point out into the river, that we really needed a joint application from both applicants. That was corrected by the agent, and the Patel application was processed for the bulkhead independently and was issued a bulkhead permit from the Wetlands Board. So all the drawings in the packet are from the original application of Mr. Hamong, but we got a revised cover sheet to add both names to the application later. Basically, that colored area is what was applied for, a 10 by 20 T-head. Basically, this is what was constructed, is a 20 by 21, it's a little closer view. These are subsequent drawings that were submitted by the agent after staff's program technician did a compliance check and noted the discrepancies. I then visited the site myself, confirmed those dimensions, and we contacted the agent and the applicants, indicating that the structure was beyond the authorized dimensions, and requested information on why that happened. We issued a notice to comply and a sworn complaint. We did receive a letter from Mr. Flint of Flint Construction, dated December 11th, 2006, along with a revised application requesting after-the-fact authorization for the pier as currently constructed. The agent contractor indicated that the T-head was expanded after it became apparent that, quote, the platform was not big enough for the property owners to enjoy or even use their boat lifts. As you can see, there are boat lifts on either side for each property owner. The original letter did not contain any explanation of why the agent contractor did not seek a modification of the permit. However, he did submit a subsequent letter on December the 28th, indicating that he was aware of the need to submit a revision but had forgot to submit the proper paperwork. This is basically what the pier looks like today, again with the larger T-head deck and the two slips. And I'll just leave that one up. Our summary and recommendation: if the pier had and the T-head, as currently constructed, had been proposed as a single-family pier in front of one single lot, it would have qualified for the permit exemption currently provided within the code. As such, staff does not believe that the current T-head to be excessive in size in light of its joint use by two property owners with boat lifts along each side. Additionally, staff is not certain that the property owners fully understood the permit process and were relying on their agent contractor to obtain all the necessary permits. However, as noted in the December 28th letter from the agent, 2006, he did acknowledge that he had modified the T-head. He did realize that submittal of additional information was required to determine if a permit modification was required. Therefore, staff recommends that you approve the after-the-fact request, but that the commission consider acceptance of an appropriate civil charge for the agent contractor in this case based on a minimal environmental impact and a moderate to major degree of noncompliance in lieu of any need for further enforcement action. I'd be happy to answer any questions. I believe the agent is here.
Any questions, Mr. Stagg? Then I've got one question. In your evaluation, it says the agent contractor indicated that the T-head was expanded after it became apparent that the platform was not big enough for the property owners to enjoy or even use their boat lifts. Who made that determination? Did the property owners convey that to the contractor, or did the contractor make that determination?
My understanding is the property owners conveyed that, but I believe he'll be able to answer that for
some. Thank you, sir. Thank you very much. Are the applicants here or represented? The agent. Good afternoon, sir.
Good afternoon, sir.
You solemnly swear the testimony that you're about to give will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. So have you got it? State your name, please, and who you represent. That's the other one.
Sorry. Chris Flint with Flint Construction.
All right. Tell us what happened. And why?
Basically, I applied for a permit originally with the two owners. They wanted a 10 by 20. We put up the two boat lifts, and when they got out there, they each have very large families. They decided it wasn't enough room. I thought it qualified for the exemption. The only reason it didn't qualify is because the property line splits the pier in half, and I was not aware of that. I had planned on submitting a revision. In fact, my draftsman in my office made a revision. We made the revision for the bulkhead. It did not come separate. It was the two permits at first, and then later on we added the bulkhead. I added the bulkhead to it, and he actually made the revision to another drawing in the Suffolk Lake. And Mr. Stagg never got the revision. As soon as I found out that that the second permit I did not include the revision, I immediately went and made the revision. It's just an oversight on my part. I'm doing 60 and 70 permits a month. I deal with staff on a day-to-day basis, and it's
how's going to be my question. How long have you been doing this business?
10 years.
10 years.
Yes, sir. Never been up for the commission. I follow the rules, and I try to, you know.
Where are you based out of?
Virginia Beach in Portsmouth.
Any questions for the gentleman? Thank you, sir.
Yes, sir.
The matter is before the commission for action. Mr. Schick, then Mr. Holland.
I move to accept staff's recommendation, including appropriate civil charges.
What would be the appropriate civil charge?
That's
$1,200 to $1,800.
$1,200 to $1,800.
Yeah, to be payable by the contractor agent.
I think we have to nail down a specific number, don't we?
Yeah, $1,200.
Oh, I thought you said $1,200 to $1,800. Okay. Is there a second to the motion?
Second.
Second by Mr. Robbins. Further discussion? All in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
Motion. Mr. Chairman, I abstain since I was out of the room.
Okay, Dr. McConaughey abstains. Vote is 8-1. Get with staff, they'll be able to assist you. Thank you. Next item on the agenda is public comments. Anyone here would like to address any matter before the commission that's not listed on the agenda? Going once? Yes, sir. Come forward.
You want to do this, man? Public comments. You want to do it?
How you doing?
Doing okay. Thanks for the opportunity. My name is Tommy Eskridge. I'm a conch fisherman. I live on Tangier Island. First of all, I'd like to point out that in our fishery, our expenses have increased so much over the past few years that we're paying four times more for bait than we were when we first started. Our fuel, I don't have to tell you about that. That's pretty well increased, double. In the last 4 months, my friend had pointed out that we only work 50 days. In 4 months because of the weather and the cold water. And with that in mind, what we would like for the commission to consider is that each boat be able to hold two inshore conch permits, provided that there are two commercial registration licenses on the boat.
Jack or Rob? Rob?
How are you? We had a similar provision back in 1996, which lasted probably for about a year, I think, where if you had two permits on board, you could have double the limit, which is 60 bushels per vessel, so they could have 120 bushels per vessel, and I think that's what this gentleman is asking. Of course, we're now in a licensing situation where the license is predicated on two conditions. One, that you had a permit in the past, and two, that you harvested offshore in the EEZ in federal waters sometime between January of 1997 and October of 1999. So it would be in keeping with what is done in the past, and really it is an efficiency measure. We don't look at it as a situation where the resource, which has a lot of unknowns to begin with, would be exploited to a greater extent.
Well, does an emergency exist now when we need to undertake it at this point, or do we set it up for public hearing? And I mean, it sounds like a win all the way around. It conserves fuel. It does a lot of things. I mean, air pollution.
You're going to hear later today about the state of our reporting system and our landings for this fishery,
okay,
which is not good overall. However, with the data that we have, I did look at the landings. April and May are certainly strong months, and then after that, it tapers off quite a bit. Whether it's an emergency, I would think it'd be better if we could come back in the public hearing in April. It would be a little extra time, and it may be some discomfort to some of the harvesters, but we'd like to get a good evaluation together. When we crafted the original 60 bushel limit, it was really a compromise. We had a committee back that time, a working committee that met, and the 60 bushels was a compromise between a call for a 6-inch size limit, which we eventually went to 5.5, and if we went to 5.5, we would keep it at 60. Then, in 1996, there was a request made by two Virginia Beach fishermen who wanted to double up on one boat. I don't know how many else did back then. Clearly, with the fuel costs in these times, some additional ones would. But we'd prefer to wait till next month and have a public hearing, would be our position.
Mr. Bowden.
I've talked to Mr. Hendricks about this a great deal. I think it is probably a good thing to streamline the fishery because the expenses increase so much. There's very little increase in potential effort, and that's what we gauge everything by, is potential effort, because there's only 38 permit holders, I believe, Mr. Roth.
There are 81 licensees.
Now, well, how many of
those are active? It's hard to sort all that out, but there are 81 licenses.
So, I mean, we've already figured potential in there.
Yes.
By having a number of licenses. It's only going to apply to in-state fishermen because they're a non-migratory species and we don't have to allow out-of-state fishermen to participate in it. I think probably emergency doesn't exist right now because the conch fishery is not active. And, they've had to deal with this for a number of years already. And if they lose 2 weeks where they can only land 60 bushel and we come to some resolution to have some permanency to it, I think they'd be willing to wait. So I believe when the chair deems it appropriate, I would like to make a motion to hold a public hearing concerning this and any issues that staff thinks appropriate at our April meeting.
The chair deems it appropriate now to make such a motion.
So moved. Yes.
Second.
Second by Mr. Holland.
I have a question.
Yes, Mr. Fox.
When you say the gentleman asked for two permits on board, that's two permits and the permit holders also, right?
Right.
Or it's
what
not,
happens
just,
is
not just someone fishing an inactive permit.
Right.
That's correct, because I think they mentioned
two registered
watermen on board.
On board.
To go along, to coincide with two permits.
I'm glad you said that an emergency does not exist, because it's been my policy throughout. I do not like someone coming before the commission of public comment with changing law. So I appreciate your position on that. Further discussion? All in favor of the motion to advertise for public hearing the measure that Mr. Bowden very eloquently stated, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? We'll certainly look at it next month, and sounds good. At this, not to prejudge it, but who's next? Come forward, sir. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, sir. My name is Hank Jones. I'm a clam farmer from the Eastern Shore.
Good to see you, Mr. Jones.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate the opportunity to come before you all and speak about our little industry over home. We have recently gotten a much-needed aquaculture permit implemented in our industry, but we are having some problems with it, as the whole industry is. We're having some growing pains. Some of our growers are falling through the cracks on this and have not been notified. And we have a terrible problem in the industry notifying growers. The permit as it is in going now, if I'm going to go catch and catch product, I have to have my permit on my boat. If my son is working on another piece of leash grain, and as you all know, most of us have several pieces of grain, if he's working on a remote piece of grain, he has to have a permit. Now, my permit has on it my height, weight, hair color, and so forth and so on, and a 16-year-old kid that's that high doesn't actually fit, nor does a 28-year-old Hispanic that weighs 160 pounds. So, therefore, do we have to have licenses for each one of those? And if so, who reports what? And that is the key to the whole thing. We don't mind buying the license, but we need to get our reporting in order so that everything is reported and is only reported once.
Let me address the license first, and I'll ask Jim or one as far as the reporting scheme to answer that. I think when this license was first initiated, it came about as a request from the aquaculturist.
Yes, sir.
They asked to be recognized and they asked to be regulated because there were a number of individuals, not a number, but some that were deemed to be bad actors. And they wanted a way to, for the commission, if we have one or two out there, given the industry a black eye or whatever, to be able to bring them before the commission to regulate them, throw a net somewhere, improper disposal of that, or stealing or whatever it might be. So I think from a licensing perspective, in order for the program to be effective, that the license should be obtained. That's my opinion. Now, from the reporting perspective, Rob, did you want to address that, or is Dr. Wesson?
I think Dr. Wesson will address the reporting.
Jim? All right. Follow up on the license.
And address the reporting right now.
Good. Thank you. I like efficiency like that. Ms. Iverson, good afternoon, ma'am.
Good afternoon, Commissioner. With the licenses currently the way they are, they can have one agent. If they have multiple agents, each agent will have to have a license on their boat outside. You can have one person using your license, but you cannot have two or three people using the same license.
Okay.
On different vessels.
The reporting aspect of it?
They have to report based on each boat, where they are, and the grow out. All of that information has to be based on the harvest, where they're harvesting at.
Mr. Holland?
You said each agency.
Each agent.
Yes, so
sir.
Are you looking at each employee as an agent?
If it's more, you allow one agent per license.
No, she can give his card.
Give your license to one other person. If he has his son and another worker out there, his son can have one. That's his. The other one, they would have to have another license.
Because of the product that they're getting for that person? Suppose you had some quote, agent working for four different product owners.
Okay. Now, Jim Weston's going to handle that one because I don't handle oyster industry. So when they have four different licensees,
that's
not
a good
sure.
Point. You're hitting on. Go ahead, Jim. All right, Mr. Jones, if you want. This is no. Granted, it's new, and it does have
growers. This is a weird industry.
We're going to work it.
I've got a boy who works for me, who works for several other farmers. We have a roving band of people that work on the Eastern Shore on claims, and they work for me. They work for Cherry Sun. They work for a lot of folks. So now you've got a fella that's working for three or four entities, and he's also got claims of his own. Now wait a minute. If he has to have a license, if I've already got two people working for me and he's the third, which happens, and it happens on a regular basis, how does he report my product that he's harvesting right. When he doesn't own it?
Right.
Who's on first, where's second, and what happens?
Well, it seems to me
he does not have to. I mean,
licensee reports.
I mean, we're trying to get people to use their common sense on how they do their reporting. When the clams belong to them, we want them to harvest. They're going to have a license anyhow. I mean, and that person for that day, if we happen to have a guy, this roving guy around that already has his own license, well, if he harvests for them that day, they can still report it under their license. And he didn't have to report that day. He only has to report his harvest that he owns.
Okay.
It's not.
So when he's acting as a laborer, the person who owns the product is the one that's supposed to report.
Right.
when he is laboring over his own product, then he reports.
But, okay, let me ask a question. How many product owners do we have? I'm going to use the Eastern Shore clam product owners.
We're finding out that. We can't tell you right now.
You don't know. Okay. Why don't we have it designed so the product owner, we get the name and address of all the product owners, and that product owner has to do, has the reporting to do. So if he has six people getting up clams for him, they come in, he counts the clams, it's his responsibility or her responsibility to report that product.
And a lot of people are doing that, but the person out doing the work has still got to have a harvesting license with him, with that team that's out in the work. He can't have, if Cherrystone sends six teams out to work one day in six different areas, somebody in each team needs to have a license. Now, they can choose to put a zero down for that day for that license and have it all go under one of the Cherrystone licenses. But it still has to tell the number of hours they spent, the harvest that they got. I mean, they can work it out to fit their individual needs. But you can't just turn it's a you can't let Cherrystone get one license and Xerox six copies and send out the six teams.
Okay.
Because if you do that, then some of the loopholes that we have problems with is that you could never get rid of the bad actors. And if you took away that license from one bad actor, then Cherrystone would lose their license, period. We have bad actors in some of the places.
I understand what you're saying, but I mean, if one of Cherrystone's employees does something wrong,
and we take away that one license that they've sent a Xerox out of, that takes all of Cherrystone's license away. Right.
Then why don't we have a license for all people that are involved in, if it's a $10 license, if you're going to be active in any type of clam production or working on clams or whatever, everybody has to have a license. But still, the product owner, I think, should be the person that has to report to us what they take in.
And they still can do that.
I think it's just
they can still do that as a firm license, and the ones that actually doing the harvest actually they just put a zero down for their report, and it all goes on the Cherrystone's report.
Sir, if I could, I don't mean to say that I know it all by a long shot, but if Tommy goes out and he works for me and George and Tom and Dick and Harry, and he has seven licenses, so he can work for those folks, what are you going to do to him 4 years from now or 3 years or 2 years from now when he's got seven licenses and a total of 28 license years, and he keeps buying a license, and he ain't got anything to report? It's ludicrous. I mean, this is a whole bunch of silly mess that got blown out of proportion from what we had in the committee meeting that night.
You've just hit on an excellent point. Bill Pruitt was very good at this. I think what we need to do is get the group together. Sitting here and hashing this out after a long day is not going to work it out. So I think, in all due respect, what I'd like to do is convene a meeting of the Aquaculture Committee so we can all have an understanding. And if we can do so, post haste, and any other issues that may come forward, and if you would facilitate, yeah, absolutely, I do. Because the way I was looking at it, my position from a law enforcement perspective would be, as you said, everyone ought to have a license, so everyone is beholden to the commission from a disciplinary perspective and for the benefit. So if you can convene that, work that out, and let everybody know, that would be great. And thank you for bringing that to our attention. Absolutely.
I hate to worry you, but I appreciate
you. You're not worrying us. That's why we're here.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
I'll get out of your way.
You're not in my way. After today, I'm going to Jamaica on Sunday. Nothing in my way. I can guarantee you. See you there. Anyone else in public comment before we move along? Okay, the next item on the agenda, public hearing. Amendments to Regulation 4 VAC 2670-10 and 4 VAC 243010. concerning the use of anchored gill nets licensed for recreational purposes and set in areas above the saltwater freshwater recreational license boundary lines on the James, York, and Rappahannock River.
Your name goes in here.
Mr. O'Reilly. Thank you, sir.
Okay.
This is the gizzard shed.
It's a travel shed.
There are two different regulations coming around with a very slight modification to them, which I'll explain shortly. This issue actually dates back to last fall when it was first brought to your attention, actually by Mr. Garrison, who was then an associate member, who had had conversations with the Department of Game and Inland Fisheries about a very prominent and growing catfish fishery in the upper portions of the tidal rivers and some problems that were associated with the use of those nets. It was delayed until today because we thought there may be some legislation that might show up during the 07 session that looks at jurisdictional issues between VMRC and the Department of Game and Inland Fisheries. That legislation never appeared, so we're home free in that respect. Virginia has a very large and apparently popular catfish fishery in the upper portions of the river, drawing participants from not only our immediately adjoining states to the north and south, but from Ohio and Kentucky and West Virginia and Tennessee. And they're primarily after the blue catfish, which was an introduced species some decades ago, which reach a very large size. The problem is the fishermen who pursue the catfish have switched from using cast nets to catch their bait, which tends to be gizzard shad, to recreational anchored gill nets. And this is cause of concern to both us and the Game and Inland Fisheries, Fisheries Division. There have been some cases where, because people are shifting from cast nets to a new gear, they're not familiar with it, like they should be. There have been cases where nets have been discarded or abandoned and continue to fish. There are concerns about bycatch of other important species like the American shad, which is in serious trouble, and the striped bass, which is another heavily regulated species. In the process of looking at jurisdictional issues between us and the Game Department actually, for the first time in a long while, realized that freshwater fish, like the gizzard shad, that are found in tidal waters actually fall under their jurisdiction, and there is a law on the books that prevented their harvest by gill net. So the gill net activity that was actually being pursued by these catfish fishermen was actually illegal. But the Game Department, wishing to continue this catfish fishery because it is so popular, it's a good thing for the economy of Virginia, and it's not harming the resource, at least the catfish resource, has recently amended their laws to allow the legal harvest of species like gizzard shad by recreational gill net. So that issue has been taken care of. The issue that remains is what effect is this proliferation of recreational gill nets in the upper river areas having on other resources. And in fact, the number of licenses that have been sold for recreational gill nets has, in 1 year's time, has increased from 565 to 722. So there, now, I can't tell you that entire increase is due to the catfish fishery, but obviously a significant portion of it is. To further address the problem, actually, Tom Powers, I think, who most of you know, apparently was acquainted with a number of these catfish fishermen and was helpful to staff in gathering a number of these fishermen together last fall that we met with and
identified the problem to, and in one evening we were able to come to an agreement with them as to how to solve the problem, and they all agreed to reduce the legal length of these anchored recreational gill nets from 300 feet to 110 feet. The reason you have a blue page regulation is the previous version said 100 feet, and it's been changed now to the 110, which was agreed to by the group. To limit the soak time in any one setting to 1 hour, which reduces the take of the other species like shad or striped bass, to require the attendance of the net within 100 yards, to require confiscation of any unattended net by the Marine Police, and that those provisions should apply in those portions of the tidal rivers above the lines that are set where you have to have a freshwater fishing license. And they're defined in the regulation that you have before you. We have received 5 or 6 comments on the proposals. All but one was in support. The catfish fishing groups that we met with were all unanimously in support, and the Finfish Management Advisory Committee supports the changes as well. That's all I have, unless you have questions.
Any questions for Jack? Mr. Fox.
Jack, we've got, how about the bycatch that these gill nets are catching? Is that a serious problem to the shad and striped bass?
We don't have in terms of presenting numbers to you as to the quantity of that bycatch, we don't have that. What we do have are the reports and the concerns of the Department of Game and Inland Fisheries, whose people are more, you know, located in those upper river reaches than my staff, obviously. And they are concerned about that bycatch.
Well, the cast nets don't have that problem. Is that correct?
Generally correct.
Why do we want to have any gill nets at all? Can't the catfish fishermen use the cast nets?
They can, but they're the concern they expressed to us was actually one of safety, that this is a wintertime fishery, and when you're throwing that cast net and then dropping it on the water, on the vessel, it's freezing. The water starts to freeze. They're in very small boats, small John boats and bass boats and things of that nature. The other provision that we're changing in the regulation, which I failed to mention, are changes in the marking requirements to the regulations for the same safety reasons. Right now, they have to abide by the same marking requirements as commercial fishermen, which involves placing a staff on the end of each net with flags or these large balls. By the time you get all that in your boat, it's actually taking up most of the room of the vessel. And so we want to do away with that and just require them to mark the nets similarly to the way commercial fishermen mark drift gill nets in the upriver, which with small blaze orange floats at each end.
Mr. Robbins?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jack, are you satisfied that the combination of the one-hour soak time limit and the length limit together will help control
bycatch
concerns?
I think so. And the requirement that you have to attend the net.
Right.
You know, in 1 hour, you're going to have that net out of the water. You're going to be right there. You should be able to release the other species.
You have some live release, presumably.
You would think so. Certainly striped bass that time of year should be able to be released alive.
Thank you.
Further questions? Thank you, Jack. So public hearing. Anyone here in support or opposition? Mr. Powers. Thank you very much for your help on the matter.
My name's Tom Powers. I'm here just representing myself. I got involved with this through the Tidal Fish Internet Bulletin Board. The freshwater guys there was an ongoing debate about using gill nets in these rivers. Previous to Mr. Garrison's discussion, And the issue there was people who didn't know how to use them, and they were setting them and just leaving them, and they were getting away from them and things. But that was a minor thing compared to the concern that DGIF had about bycatch. When Jack and I met with these guys, we met with a half a dozen people who have been using gill nets for years legally. And currently they can use a 100-yard gill net and soak it for as long as they want, so long as they stay with the net in these areas. Their report was very minimal bycatch when set for gizzard shad. They set in the shallow areas. Typically what they'll do is just have the net still attached one end to their boat, and they'll just feel the net, and they'll feel the fish tapping on the net, and after 5 or 10 minutes, 15 minutes, they'll pull the net in. Any bycatch they catch is returned to the water alive, and that's the point behind the one-hour soak time. There is a concern with bycatch in this area, and it's been reported to me from commercial fishermen, and it has to do with the white perch fishery and has a bycatch of 1-to-1, and I've heard as high as 5-to-1 and 10-to-1 of striped bass to white perch. But that's a separate issue that is not covered by this regulation. The Luke Hatfish fishermen like the use of the gill net because it allows them, like Jack said, it's a danger issue when they're in there in the dead of winter. They really did support this, and this also was a matter when DGIF did their changes to their regulations to allow the harvest of gizzard shad and white perch by recreational fishermen through the use of gill nets. It was done with the understanding that this agency would be looking into these specific measures. And I did that I will present it to FMAC as a request to come here.
Response. A question, couldn't would the fishermen using these gill nets, would they be agreeable to not fishing the nets at all during the spawning runs for the shad and the
spawning
bass?
Fish is not the problem. The problem, the fish you catch are this big. Mm-hmm. They're using a 3.5-inch mesh net. They aren't going to catch the big stripers, as a general rule.
But
they might lip hook them, or lip gill them, but that's it.
But they'll catch the shad.
The ones that I have talked to have not reported catching any shad. Now, one of the options that we talked about previously was the concept of closing sections of the river.
Let me just add that you cannot set an anchored gill net in the shad and striped bass spawning areas during April and May.
So that
applies to every anchored gill net.
Okay.
And it would apply to these as well.
So that's when the shad are going up the road.
Right. That's when they're spawning up there, yes.
Thanks, Tom. Sorry. We're talking about a 33-yard net, right, Jack? 130. Thank you, Professor.
Yeah.
Well, I got them out there, guys. Anybody else? Matters before the commission for action. Mr. Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move that we adopt staff recommendation.
Second.
Second.
Thank you, Mr. Tanker. Further discussion? All in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All opposed? Motion carries unanimously. Thank you very much. Next item on the agenda, public hearing. Planned construction of a new artificial recreational fishing reef, Bluefish Rock, to be centered 3.2 nautical miles east-southeast of the Grandview section of Hampton. Mr. Meyer.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, sir.
At your February 27th meeting, the Artificial Reef Program requested time on this month's agenda to consider approval of development of the reference reef site. The proposed site to be located 3.3 nautical miles east-southeast of the Grandview section of Hampton. The request was granted with the understanding that both commercial and recreational interests would be contacted in order to gain their input on the location of this reef. Invitations to a meeting to be held on March 14th were mailed out. The meeting was held as scheduled here at VMRC. In attendance were C.D. Hancock, Susan Gaston, and Kelly Place, representing commercial interests, and W.E. Bradley, K.E. Neal, Frank Kearney, Bob Allen, James Cross, David Agee, and Tom Powers, representing the recreational sector. Commercial input was also received from Pete Freeman, who was unable to attend the meeting. Basically, the recreational fishermen were pleased with the site as is currently proposed. However, commercial fishermen strongly preferred that the site be moved either east or to the southeast. Mr. Freeman suggested the site be moved to the north where there was rocky bottom. The commercial people in attendance were not strongly supportive of moving in that direction. The recreation representatives had no problem with moving the reef approximately 500 yards to the east or southeast, which may possibly incur additional problems with tugboat traffic. An agreement was reached whereby the artificial reef program would be responsible for seeing that the suggested areas, which are considerable in size, were surveyed, and further, that a second meeting with commercial and recreational interests be in attendance would be held on May 3rd, with the findings of that meeting presented at the May Commission meeting. At this point, at the point in time that I wrote this, March 20th, over 100 recommendations to proceed with the reef as is currently proposed had been received. Since then, I've received approximately 50 more. The staff recommendation here is to proceed with investigation of the alternate locations, with the second meeting of the two groups to be involved be held in May. At that point in time, the results of the investigation, which will primarily consist of side scan sonar surveys, will be discussed, and at that point in time, some resolutions hopefully will be reached. We then would approach you folks at the May meeting and present the findings to you from that early May meeting with the recreational commercial interests.
So what you're asking basically is to continue this until the May meeting?
That's correct.
Okay, first of all, since it's advertised, is there anyone here that really has a lot of heartburn and desire to speak on it now before they have their further meeting? Okay. I'll entertain a motion from the commission. Mr. Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Move to continue this matter to the May meeting.
Second to the motion?
Second. Motion, and I would like to add that it is my sincere hope that we can come up with a compromise that commercial and recreational can agree on.
As always. Second by Mr. Holland. Further discussion? All in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion carries unanimously. Thank you, Mike, for your good work on there and everybody's attempt to compromise. Item number 15, public hearing amend regulation 4 VAC 245010 to establish 2007 commercial bluefish quota of 1,018,660 pounds. Mr. Griss.
Yes, this item is for public hearing on page 2 of regulation 4 VAC 20450-10, section 30, establish the 2006 commercial quota at 1,124,334 pounds for bluefish. National Marine Fisheries Service announced on a January 30, 2007 letter for the ASMFC Bluefish Management Board, the coastwide commercial quota equal to 8.5 million pounds, of which 1,018,660 pounds is allocated to Virginia commercial fishery. Staff recommends adoption of the amendment to Regulation 4 VAC 2450-10 that established the 2007 Virginia commercial bluefish quota at 1,018,660 pounds.
Any questions for Mr. Grist? Thank you. This is a public hearing. Anyone in the audience, pro or con, on the matter? The matter is before the commission for action.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Mr. Robbins.
Thank you. Move that we adopt staff's recommendation establishing the quota for 2007 at 1,018,660 pounds.
Mr. Holland?
Second.
Second by Mr. Holland. Any further discussion? All in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion carries unanimously. Thank you. Item number 16, public hearing, Regulation 4, VAC 20-950-10 at sea, pertaining to black sea bass, consideration of alternate methods for allocation of 2007 commercial harvest quota between directed and bycatch fisheries. Mr. Cimino.
Yes, sir. Afternoon, Commissioner, members of the board. Last month, the Commission held a public hearing to set the 2007 black sea bass quotas. Just prior to that meeting, staff on February 21st, staff met with several individuals from the directed fishery who put forth an alternate proposal. The proposal was similar to what staff was recommending at the February Commission meeting, in that it proposed to set a larger portion of the commercial quota for the directed fishery. The intention being to lessen the hardship of the 2007 quota reduction on permit holders who most depend on it. The proposal made by the individuals would allocate additional quota taken from the bycatch and the hardship quotas and divide it amongst the directed permit holders based on each permittee's average percentage of the 2004 through 2006 harvest. It's their belief that a second benefit of allocating the quota to the directed permit holders who, based on past harvest, are most likely to use it is that a greater portion of Virginia's overall quota may be harvested. It's a very real concern that Virginia, who holds one of the largest coastwide quota shares, if they continue to leave a large portion of that quota uncaught, states that receive a smaller percentage will request distribution percentage be revised. A state like Massachusetts, who receives 13% of the coastwide quota, whereas Virginia's at 20%, and they have no problem of catching their entire quota, could request that an ASMFC management board that state shares be redistributed. At the February 27th public hearing, staff requested this public hearing to allow time for comment on the proposal just described. Staff sent a letter explaining the proposal to all permit holders, therefore all involved in the Black Sea Bass fishery, and requested comments to be addressed either at this public hearing or prior to this hearing via phone or written response. To date, I've received 8 endorsements for this proposal. And in addition, there were 3 permit holders, directed permit holders, who said they support the amount of quota going to the directed fishery. However, they feel that the distribution should be based solely on the current shares of the permit holders. By basing the quota distribution on recent harvest, these individuals were concerned that a precedent would be set that would precipitate the person who's inactive in the fishery for a year or two of being forced out. I know that there are several individuals who may like to comment, so I'll leave that open for them and then take any questions. And you'll see that staff recommendation here is to go with the proposal. You also have before you the draft regulation that would that addresses the required amendments for that proposal.
Any questions, Joe? Mr. Robbins?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to make sure I understand that what we're doing is proposing to reallocate quota that in recent years has been unutilized?
That's correct. Okay. Yes, and that is the table that you have before you.
Thanks. Any other questions? Thank you, Joe. This is a public hearing. Anyone pro or con wants to speak on this matter? Yes, sir. Come forward. And Jimmy, you can be next if you'd like, sir. Good afternoon.
My name is Mark Hodges, and I'm a commercial trap fisherman here for sea bass out of Rudy Inlet. And there's really not a whole lot. I'm in favor of the motion, of course, and I was one of the people that met with Joseph. And it's really not a whole lot to add to what Joseph had to say, so I can be brief. I know you had a long day, so thank you. Any questions?
Thank you, Mark. Appreciate it. Mr. Rule? Good to have you up here in the Commonwealth, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for your time to the board. I just, Jimmy Rule. I'm a commercial fisherman from North Carolina, operate out of Hampton, Virginia, but I'm also a member of Mid-Atlantic Fisheries Management Council. And I think the action of not the council, but the National Marine Fisheries is a result of why this present proposal is being made. The council supported 6.5 million pound quota for the upcoming year in lieu of the 8 million previous years. The National Marine Fisheries Service went with 5. So you're looking at a 3 million pound reduction in the quota. I couldn't support the 8 million because in my opinion the fish does have a problem. That resource does have a problem regardless of where it is found in the ocean and all of those issues. I can in fact support this proposed suggestion by the directed holders with the caveat that this not become a precedent setter, because you're basically reallocating portions of the stock that are not utilized. But there's a very significant, there's two main reasons why the bycatch quota is not being caught. One is summer flounder fishery traditionally has a bycatch of sea bass. Usually the larger fish because of the mesh requirements. Summer flounder fishery offshore waters has been so good in recent years that the number of days and tows required to catch the trip limit is significantly reduced. So therefore, you don't have the opportunity to accumulate it. The other issue is dogfish. The sheer abundance of dogfish in the open waters of the ocean do not allow trawlers to participate and tow areas that they would pick up a few sea bass along with a few fluke. Everything is just compacted together. It's unreal what's going on out there. So with that in mind, I can in fact support. The biggest concern that I got is there may very well be further reductions in this stock. and it's not going to be an effect of what's out there. The National Marine Fisheries Service is entering a very critical stage when it comes to stock assessments. We've got a new boat, new gear, all coming online. We're going to fall into this black hole where no new information is going to come out. So if you are on a trajectory down or a trajectory up, that's going to carry you through. And my concern is that if this action is taken as an emergency action to respond to the 38%, that's fine. But don't let it be every time you have a reduction, it's one of the other entities has to pay for it. Because sooner or later, things will change to where the bycatch quota comes up. The hardship thing, I have no idea what that is, how that would, you know, increase the quota. I'm all for keeping Virginia's historical landings because actually the trawlers helped generate that those numbers in years past. That's neither here nor there. I do appreciate the opportunities that the board and the VMRC have given us to utilize this letter of authorization, which allows trawlers to catch directed permitters holders fish. And you all need to keep that in mind when you start talking about who gets the most out of reallocating by other than percentage. Because, in fact, all of those fish may not have been caught by the permit holder. We're all in it to try to maintain the quota and keep Virginia's portion. But, again, my biggest concern is I don't want to see a precedent set. I don't mind an emergency action for this year, but I don't know what the future holds. None of us do. And I don't want to do anything that could, in fact, create a bycatch discard that does nobody any good. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Jimmy. Good to have you. Anybody else? Thank you. Okay. Close the public hearing. The matter is before the commission for action. Mr. Robbins?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do have a question for staff based on Mr. Rule's testimony, and I wonder if it would be appropriate that we consider the allocation scheme on an annual basis.
Yes, that's correct. And if you take a look at the regulation, you'll see that, and that's one of the reasons why I'm before you so often, that this is one of the quotas that is, it specifically states in the regulation that this is, we're setting it by year. So this is a 2007 quota allocation.
Okay, thank you.
Any further questions? Chair, entertain a motion.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that we adopt staff's recommendation to amend the regulation for VAC 20-950-10.
Second.
Second by Mr. Holland. Further discussion? All in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries unanimously. Thank you, Joe. Item number 17, and I'm not going to read the entire thing. What this does is adopt the emergency regulations pertaining to the crab fishery that we did in February. Let Rob fill in the
blank. Somewhere in this pocket, I have it. Just knock something off.
Did it pull completely?
Yeah.
All right. Boy, Rob, this is a young man's game.
Well, Mr. Bowden, you've elevated it from FMAC to the commission now, so
I'm in trouble. Young at heart, right?
Thank you.
I'm passing around a summary management measures from 1994 through 2002, and I think that the listing will be helpful for both of the agenda items today. And you know, you may or may not know about all of these that occurred starting really in 1994, but certainly today, one of the items, the regulation that established by emergency the early open season for podding is March 17th, is something new only from the perspective of 1995 forward. Prior to 1995, there was a season during that time period for podding. And I think the easiest thing to do is to just go to the regulations in Regulation 270, page 3 of 5, you can see the dates for the amendment that we're proposing to be part of the permanent regulation establishing the season starting March 17th.
So in paragraph A, it's unlawful to knowingly place, set, or fish any hard crab pot or peeler crab pot from December 1 through March 16th. So that means it can be open March 17. In paragraph B on page 3, you can see another amendment from the emergency regulation last month, which shifts the dates of having a fish pot in the water, and that's all it really does. It coincides with the open season of March 17th, so it shifts those dates when you cannot have a fish pot, and last month and this month, there's information as to why that original regulation was passed on fish pots, really not to give a competitive advantage to some in the industry who want to set fish pots and then license them as crab pot when April 1 came about. On page 2 of the regulation, you can see the third amendment to Regulation 270, and that's concerning the time of day restriction. Before it was April 1, the month of April had a 6 a.m. to 2 p.m. Time of day restriction, and what this does, it just moves it backwards to March the 17th to coincide with the start of the season. The second regulation, if you go to the end of your evaluation, the next to the last page of your evaluation, but Regulation 300, you can see the amendment from last month that we're proposing as a permanent part of this Regulation 300 that would establish the 51 bushel limit or 17 barrel limit starting in March 17th, again, the start of the potting season, whereas before it was April 1 through May 31. Back in 1987, which is the earliest time that we could trace this regulation, it was set as March 15th. So the bushel limit was in effect from March 15th through May 31st when it was first enacted. There were a couple of comments at the Crab Management Advisory Committee concerning the timing of the season. There were some complicated suggestions to perhaps look at every third Monday in the month and have varying dates and everything else. And I think in the end result, everyone agreed that just keeping it March 17th was the way for the future. And this is, of course, for next year and beyond at this time. Staff is certainly recommending adoption of the amendments in Regulation 270, the three amendments, and the one in 300. There were some other comments, though, that I wanted to share with you, and one concerned the information that came to our deputy commissioner last month, which was some crab dredgers became concerned that during the March 17th to the end of March, when the dredge fishery is still in operation and crabs come up, start to move a little bit, get towards the shallows, the dredgers can have a pretty good harvest right there at the end of the season. I don't know whether anyone's here today to speak on that or not. We haven't heard anything else. I believe it was off Ocean View where this was occurring. And the concern was that if the pots were there, there would be conflict. There would be pots in the place where they wish to dredge. Again, I don't know whether we'll hear more about that. The other public comment that was received was the Maryland Department of Natural Resources contacted us, and they had a couple of concerns. One concern was in all the bi-state activity since 2000 and the Chesapeake Bay Stock Assessment Committee advisory reports since 2000, there has been information termed management advice, which is always to keep regulations the way they are. And I guess my counterpart in Maryland was concerned that regulations were being changed. And, you know, I pointed out to this person, Lynn Fegley, I said, well, really, most of that advice occurred after 2000. Certainly, you can't really look in the past, especially back to a time period of 1995 when regulation setting was never a joint activity with Maryland and Virginia. And I think the summary sheet you have shows that there have been quite a few different regulations aimed at conservation the most prevalent for the spawning stock to augment the spawning stock. She accepted that type of information. The other comment was that Lynn had concerns that the dredge harvest overall as a situation is taking the females from an area Coal Point South. And the way she described it was that Maryland DNR staff has looked at data of the number of females that are available from that geographic location south, and they have had a pretty high correlation of the dredge fishery actually exploiting a significant fraction if they're there. If there's not a significant fraction there, and that fraction is determined by the Baywide Winter Dredge Survey conducted by VIMS and Maryland DNR. And so she had some concerns there. I sent her this type of information, and what you can see is here is a dredge season, which wraps around December 1 through March 31st. You can see the total pounds attributed to the dredge seasons through time, and you can certainly see that probably from the 2000-2001 season, it's pretty constant in terms of the overall harvest. It certainly doesn't rival some of the other seasons in the 5 and 7 million pound quantity. And there should be no surprise there. Industry came to the commission in 1993 and said they wanted to reduce the dredge fleet. And I think the licenses have been reduced from about 387 down to below 220. Because we were able to have a lottery. And I think the practical dredge fishing effort today in these years down here is much less as well. Some of our flyover counts may get 60-some boats at the most on any one given week. So the dredge fishery has a lot of overhead, a lot of costs. It's not what it was. But I wanted to point out to her that in terms of the percentage of the total dredge fishery in March 17th through 31st, it's a pretty small portion. You know, 4% might be a high portion. It varies as low as less than 1% a couple of years here. Then you put that in terms of the annual statewide harvest, and if I'd had more time, I would have just chosen female crabs because the dredge fishery is about 95% females. But in terms of the overall harvest, you are looking at a very small fraction. So at least staff felt it worthwhile to address those concerns, and you know, I'm sure that, you know, maybe we'll hear some more down the road a little bit, but those are the only concerns or comments that I'm familiar with at this time, and really that's all I have, Commissioner.
Thank you. Any questions, Rob? Rick?
Thank you,
Mr. Robbins?
Just one question, a point of clarification, Rob. You said that this would be a permanent change to the regulation. While technically that may be true, we had also discussed the importance of reviewing the catch data for 2007 as soon as that's available. So the committee is going to take that up and just to try to determine if in fact a 51 bushel limit during that period is appropriate.
To staff and to the commission, permanent means until it's changed. So what we're saying is it will be in the final regulation, and if there is a change. There will be, and you're absolutely right that we are going to get those landings, and we will look at whether the 51 bushel might be too much for that time period.
No. Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Humstead, Rob. Dr. McConaughey?
Just a comment.
Question for you.
No, it's just a comment that your analysis is what the governor appointed in the 90s. The governor appointed a commission to look at the dredge fishery, and we found the same thing, that it had very little impact on the overall spawning
stuff. Well, it's interesting you say that because never fails. I bet I'm asked 50 times a year why crab dredging is allowed, and I refer back to that study and, of course, those numbers too. So, anyway, thank you, Doctor. This is a public hearing. Anyone in the public wish to speak to these amendments to make the emergency semi-permanent?
Until further notice.
Okay. No one. Matters before the commission for action. Mr. Bowden.
Move to approve staff recommendation.
Motion made by Mr. Bowden, second by Mr. Schick. Further discussion? All in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion carries unanimously.
Thank you. Next item on the agenda, public hearing, proposed amendment to Regulation 4 VAC 20-37010 to repeal the prohibition on harvest and possession of dark sponge crabs and establish an additional blue crab sanctuary in an area that extends out to the 3-mile limit line from the mouth of the Chesapeake Bay, then southward along Virginia Beach coast to Virginia, North Carolina line. Thank you, Joe.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you, sir.
I think what I want to start out by saying, Dr. Lipschitz has been visiting us for quite a while. He's back there now. He's been here for several hours, and I know he's been talking to Mike Meyer about artificial reefs as well. Dr. Lipschitz had contacted us earlier in the week and asked that this be postponed in terms of a decision. And staff agrees with that for two reasons, and they both involve Dr. Lipschitz. First of all, Dr. Lipschitz and his staff have been involved in looking into the sponge crab issue and the mortality of sponges and female crabs. Dr. Lipschitz indicated he would like a little more time. I don't know whether he has a probabilistic mortality model, but he is working with Dr. John Honig at VIMS, and he also thinks there might be some peer review of this by the time we meet in April, and I'll certainly welcome his comments if we can do that in a minute. The other part of this is the sanctuary end of it, and Dr. Lipschitz has been the proponent of sanctuaries and been before the commission several times, starting back, as you can see from your summary sheet, back in 1994, there was an expansion of the sanctuary, the original 1942 sanctuary, by 75 square miles. There were also expansions that occurred in 2000, which was 435 additional square miles, and 2002, which was an additional 272 square miles, so that up until today, the sanctuary acreage is 927 square miles. So Dr. Lipschitz is also involved with that aspect of crab conservation. Staff is still recommending that you hold the public hearing today and take comments, and I think one thing that I handed out, or actually Joe handed out to you, Commissioner, was a photograph of the sponge crabs in various stages. And the way the regulation has existed, and you can find this on your summary sheet under the 1996 era, was to prohibit the possession of dark-colored, which is brown through black, sponge crabs with a 10 sponge crab per bushel tolerance. And that really involves, if you look at that photograph as it passed around, it's involving all these stages of the brown, which is harder to see here than on your photograph, through the black coloration. So it's these stages which harvesters have been able to take without having to throw back, even with the tolerance. And it's the orange masses. Certainly, Dr. McConaughey and Dr. Lipschitz have a good understanding of this process, but what I understand is that this whole event may be about a 16-day event from start to finish. So that gives you some indication of how quick in time it is. The other thing on sponge crabs that just wanted to provide to you, and that might be difficult to read. Let's see if I can bring this up differently if you have just a second. Yeah, that's better. Well, maybe not. This is an indication of what we did in 2002. In 2002, it was still the tail end of the 15% reduction in, and I'll fill in the in part in just a minute, but it was a 15% reduction, and staff, together with industry, working with industry, came up with a scenario of what it would be like to get savings from not harvesting during either a week or 2 weeks were the proposals at the time. But the important part of this information is we looked at the various areas of the bay, either the lower bay, the upper bay, or the tributaries, the lower part of the tributaries. And we came up with our best idea of multipliers, in other words, 75% of sponge crabs in May in the lower bay were considered, to 75% of females were considered to be sponged, 100% when you get to the June through August period, and so on. So you can see a more minor contribution from the lower tributaries in general. Again, this is sort of an ad hoc approach that we did with industry. But I think it's important, as you're looking at this issue and the public, to realize that we have had something, a regulation in place to throw back sponge crabs, and the science is now telling us in general that perhaps not only are we not benefiting conservation, we may be hindering it a little bit. And I'm going to paraphrase what Dr. Lipschitz told the Crab Committee last week, which was, if you think about throwing back the sponge crabs and not getting any benefit from doing that, the dark-colored sponge crabs, and then that same crabber having to move somewhere else to exploit other crabs, really the problem's worse than it should be. The second part of this is really just to give you a very general idea, which I'm going to come back to that. The second part of this is the sanctuary. And as you can see, between Joe Grist and Royce Bridger, they have been able to map out the corridor here. This is the 3 mile limit line, and you can see the existing sanctuary all through here, the 927 acres. In here, in the cleared out area, represents the original 146 square mile sanctuary that was established in 1942. Might get a better shot of it here. Here's the original 1942 sanctuary. Here's what was added on in both 2000, over here was added on in 1994, and then 2000 and 2002 are the bulk of this, with an extension out right to the bay area, right by the mouth, into the ocean. So that you can see a better idea here, there's a little tail of sanctuary offered here and down to the North Carolina line, out to the 3 mile limit line. That's what's proposed, and I think the idea was that that extra 94.2 miles of sanctuary does a couple of things. It's not currently a harvest area. In 2006, there were only two harvesters there. In the past, before this was put in place, there were more harvesters along the beach. But the important thing is, if there is to be a lifting of the prohibition of throwing back dark sponge crabs, then this is a heavily laden area with sponges, and it would be a sanctuary like the others from June 1 to September 15th. And I think most of the Crab Management Advisory Committees have been terming this as conservation equivalency, essentially. I'm not sure that it's not even a little bit better if the science tells us definitively that throwing back the dark-colored sponge crabs really does not have the benefits that were thought 12, 13 years ago. The only other thing that I have on that is that, if I can go back here successfully. Okay. I think in all of this, and if you just allow me about 2 or 3 minutes, I'll go through it. But we're trying to look at what some have viewed as piecemeal measures. You know, you're doing this, you're doing one option, you're doing another management measure, you're doing this. As you can see from the handout I gave you on the summary, the commission at all times has looked at a host of management options and selected from that menu, essentially. But the most important thing in looking at this is the objective. I think in the last 8 years, there's been a lot of work from the Bi-State Committee at some portions of that, from the Chesapeake Bay Stock Assessment Committee, which is NOAA, the state agencies, and others have been working continuously to come up with some type of a management guideline. And this is it in the form of a control rule. And if you look at this, you can see on the top, right here, a line going down. This is not an analytical basis, but this is the determination of whether the stock is overfished or not. Go to the left of that line, it's definitely overfished. Here's 2005 estimates of the stock. Certainly a big improvement compared to 2003. I don't have all the data points, but a great improvement over 1999. In fact, 1999 is the lowest abundance, 90 million crabs, and it's used as sort of an experience basis for where to set the overfish threshold. But there is a threshold there to go by now. In terms of the green line here going horizontally and the red line, those were analytically derived, and they are based on fishery science concepts. And the target right here is about 0.46, 0.47, right around in there, of a harvest rate. By a harvest rate, what fraction of the crabs are removed strictly by fishing activities each year? Well, if you're removing somewhere between 46 or 47% and 53%, which is the red line, then it tells you that the stock is in fairly good shape based on this characteristic. But this is only one characteristic, and the problems that we often see, we look at the harvest and we say, what is the harvest doing this year? What is the harvest doing this spring? And if you look at this bay-wide harvest, you can see that it's really all over the place. And you can see the reporting changes down here, Maryland twice, Virginia once in 1993. But you certainly can't avoid looking at that kind of a decline. I mean, there is a little bit of an average kick up, and on an individual year, here's 2005 and here's 2004. But the harvest is really not the only thing to go by in the management world. Now there is that control rule, and harvest is only one component. Another component that mostly all fishery management plans look at is, what is the status of the female stock, for example? And here's a depiction from the winter dredge survey. This is females, adult females, and you can see the trend. You can see that in 2005, these bands here are considered average amounts. You can see that it's average here, but you can also see that there's a lot of movement with these dredge survey points, these indices. And in fact, that's one of the reasons why, when you look more closely just at the fall VIM survey, which is done just in the spawning stock, the previous slide is bay-wide, then you can see that there's really been a pattern, which Dr. Lipschitz has talked about year after year, because I have heard it, of fairly static, little improvement in terms of the actual potential or spawning crabs on the spawning grounds. And that's really the type of thing that you have to look at. Not just the harvest, you have to also look at the spawning stock. Exploitation, as you saw a little bit before in the control rule, gives you a little bit of information. Exploitation in 2005 was quite low. 37% of the crabs removed strictly by fishing. Well below the target of 0.455 or 0.46. Well below the threshold. This dotted line here, threshold, just means once you're over that threshold, who knows how many years before you have biological instability, before you have reproductive problems in the stock. The problem right now is that we have something to show everyone. We have a control rule, but we need a little more time to see where this exploitation rate fits in, because it has bounced around too. From 0.6 down to 0.37. Here it was just at the target. So I thank you for indulging me on that, because it is a little more refined in terms of having the control rule and just looking at harvest to make management decisions, but there's going to be a few more years before we have some certainty about the exploitation rate. In the meantime, I think everyone should pay attention to the VIMS fall survey and the fact that it's been about a dozen years and, you know, the potential spawning stock or spawning stock remains at low levels. If you ask, well, then how does the exploitation rate remain low? Then that's something we need to dig in a little more deeply on what the effort is like, what the trade-offs are like to at least keep the exploitation rate down, because they are coupled, you know, with the average abundance, with the exploitation rate, and with the catch. They're all coupled together. So, again, our recommendation is to wait till next month for a decision. That's what we have is in the format of the evaluation today. And Dr. Lipschitz is here, as I mentioned.
One concern I've got, Rob, you said that staff suggests we have the public hearing today. Rob, if your information is not going to be the most recent information today, can the public make an informed comments and say what needs to be said today? You can come forward, maybe. That's my only concern. When I make comments, I want to have the best information I can. Good afternoon.
Thanks, Commissioner Bowman. Actually, I don't expect our recommendation or support of the staff recommendation to change at all. In fact, if anything, what I would expect is that it's going to get even stronger.
Okay.
So
what
we wanted to do was basically provide other elements of information. About the handling mortality, that's not going to change. We've seen that, so we think a fairly significant fraction of the sponge crabs are dying. So I can hold off until the next meeting, if you wish. I did want to mention one other thing, this dredge fishery issue.
Okay.
I was on that same committee as Dr. McConaughey, and we were also troubled over the long term. So what we've done is we've looked at some information regarding what the dredge fishery does in terms of exploitation. And just for your benefit, the dredge fishery is a well-behaved fishery in terms of, if you saw what Rob presented, right, the exploitation fraction was very high at low abundance, and the exploitation rate dropped at high abundance. That's a poorly behaved fishery. A well-behaved one is one where the exploitation fraction increases. As an example, this is a sort of a low density of people, and let's say you were to take 60% of these, 60% of them died, that's a high exploitation rate. If the audience were full, it would only take 40%, only 40% would die. That's what's happening in the overall pod fishery, I think, but not the dredge. The dredge, when it gets down this low because of overhead and such, actually takes a lower fraction of those, which allows it to rebound.
Right.
So overall, I would, I guess, reemphasize or strengthen that about the dredge fishery.
Okay. Thank you, Ron.
Mr. Chairman?
Dr. McConaughey.
Just a question, Ron.
Yes.
You and I have had some email exchanges back and forth, so that get that out there. On your reanalysis, are you going to take into consideration other factors like temperature and DO and on mortality?
We are, the data that we have, we checked on the DO, and there doesn't appear to be any problem with DO. There's high temperature. So I don't expect we're not going to actually reanalyze that data. What we're doing is preparing the, as Rob mentioned, a model that looks at displaced effort and the mortality of the brown and black sponges. And so we're going to do that. In addition, we hired a postdoctoral scientist in the back, Kate Mansfield, and she's going to do a review for you that's going to look at all the fisheries, crustacean fisheries, all crabs and lobsters, to show what trap handling mortality is like in the other ones. What we see so far is that those that are in warmer waters suffer pretty high trap-related mortality. So we'll have that review for you at that point.
Okay.
As well.
But I'm sorry, Fox. Are you going to change your opinion or your recommendation between today and next month?
I do not expect, except maybe to make it stronger. That's what I expect.
To make it stronger, meaning?
Meaning in stronger support of the staff recommendation.
Well, it would seem to me that if he's not going to change his recommendation and we've advertised for the public hearing,
That's my intent.
Why shouldn't we move forward and make a decision today?
Well, I don't know about making the decision. I had, based on the staff's request, considered deferring it, but now, well, because I would like, before we make a decision, to what if, you know, and science does change. What if it does change? And I, in something as important as this, want to have the best science available. So, Rob?
Yeah, I think staff would still say it would be prudent to wait until next month, because I've only given you a little bit of information on this whole problem.
Seemed like a lot to me.
And I think you should have the benefit of Dr. Lipschitz's full work and see what the model's telling, and then look at the other crustaceans and the behavior there. So I think you'll gain some information next month that you don't have today. I don't think, based on what Dr. Lipschitz says, it bears on the recommendation you have before you. But I do think that it would be wise to have that information.
Well, no harm will be caused by delaying the decision.
No, as a matter of fact, we have until June 1. The sanctuary effective dates are June 1 to September 15th throughout that whole sanctuary acreage.
And there's sponges out there now, right. Anyway. That's right.
And the sponge crab you saw from the graph I showed, you know, really a little bit in May starting up. But, you know, really the hot time period is still, from what I know, July 10th to August 10th, July 15th to August 15th, around that time.
Okay. Just one final item that came out of the CRAB committee is that we are going to move forward with an additional study this year looking at males as well. I was suggested that we look into that, so that will be underway.
Thank you, Ron.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think if we simply table this matter until the April meeting, that would give us the benefit of the additional information, and I don't think there's going to be any harm, obviously, given the fact that the sanctuary takes effect June 1.
Second.
Second.
Second by Mr. Fox. Further discussion? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion carries unanimously. We'll hold a public hearing. Advertise it, please, for next month, because I really do have a little bit of discomfort. No harm intended, but if people are going to comment as intelligibly as they possibly can, I want all the information out on the table before we actually have it form. Whether or not it changes, I don't know, but I would prefer that.
Plus, people like to comment when we vote.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Sure. Rob, thank you very much. Appreciate it. And Rob, thank you. The next item on the agenda, failure to report commercial harvest in accordance with mandatory reporting, Ms. Iverson.
Yes, sir. Patrick Johnson contacted our office this morning. He is not able to be here today due to transportation. He says that he will be here next month. He wanted to know if he had to be served again. Staff told him that because we talked to him on the phone, we wouldn't serve him in person. We would just send him a letter stating that he needs to be here again next month.
Is this individual... is he revoked now or suspended now?
Yes, sir. His status, and he was notified that his status will stay in suspension until he appears.
Okay, we'll continue until next month then. I don't think that needs any action. Thank you. Item 20, request for April public hearing, conservation measures for Sheepshead. These, Jack, we could, on these requests for public hearing, if we can keep them pretty brief, we could. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes?
Did you talk about Richard Johnson today, or was that just Patrick Johnson?
There were two, I
think. Steph? I'm sorry, Jeff.
That's all right.
I'm sorry. Yeah. Richard Johnson is Patrick Johnson's minor son who works along with him, so he would have to bring his son with him. He's a minor. He's under 18 years old.
Look forward to seeing him. Okay, John.
This is a request for an April public hearing. February 27th, FMAC meeting, a proposal for conservation measures for Sheepshead was presented by Tom Powers. This is a species of interest with ODU Center for Quantitative Fisheries Ecology currently finishing up their first year of a three-year planned study on Sheepshead pop dye. Staff recommends advertising for an April public hearing conservation measures for Sheep's Head to include four fish recreational possession limit and a commercial hook and line possession limit of 500 pounds.
Motion.
Mr. Chairman, I have a quick question.
Mr. Robbins, question.
I'm assuming if we do this that we could still be more conservative in the end. Is that correct? In other words, if we move this option, could we subsequently adopt a lower limit, more restrictive?
You have to get 2 to 4. I believe that you can adopt more liberal, but you cannot become more conservative.
That's correct.
Based on the public hearing. So if you wanted to be more conservative, I think you would have to advertise a smaller possession limit and a lower commercial limit in order to be more restrictive. Council's not in here, but I don't believe you can become more restrictive.
You
can't. Okay. Could we then, would one option then be to advertise a range of options up to and including the four fish recreational possession limit and a commercial limit from, say, 200 to 500
pounds? You could do that. But Joe, go ahead.
Commissioner, we can also solve this by just saying set these as a maximum.
Okay.
And that solves it, allows all ranges below to be out.
Just when you word it, make sure that allows that. That would be fine. And that's your motion?
I would offer that as a motion, Mr. Chairman, that we advertise that for public hearing.
All right, motion made by Mr. Robbins, seconded by Mr. Schick. Further discussion? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries unanimously. Thank you. Thanks. Request for public hearing, April, pertaining to horseshoe crab. Mr. Gillingham, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Commissioner. This is a request for public hearing. We're looking to define a male crab in something legally concise and enforceable, and also to establish a permitting and reporting system for seafood buyers that handle horseshoe crabs, including a call-in once a trigger is met. You may recall, but the horseshoe crab, we've got a quota, and last year was the first time the quota was actually caught, and we closed, I believe it was June 16th or 19th.
Pretty close to quota, but...
We went over just a little bit, but we realized then how fragile it was and how quickly it could be caught. And
okay.
I won't get into details.
Well, any other questions? Chair, entertain a motion.
So moved.
Seconded.
Moved by Mr. Holland to advertise for public hearing. Seconded by Mr. Schick. Further discussion. All in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed. Motion carries unanimously.
Robbins abstains.
Mr. Robbins abstains. Please note that, Kathy. Item 23, request for April public hearing to establish recreational possession, recreational and commercial possession for blue line tilefish.
Actually, 22. Channel Welt.
I'm sorry, I missed 22, didn't I? Channel Welt.
Yes, sir.
Modify the regulation. Go ahead.
Again, we're looking at modifying the definition of bait bag. In fact, I was in court when the judge made the decision that what we had was too general, couldn't be enforced. Trying to come up with a legally concise and enforceable definition of bait bag. And again, Channel Welt, Rob alluded to it earlier, that historically we've had very poor reporting in this fishery. We're asking to establish a permitting and reporting system for seafood buyers that handle channeled welt.
Okay. Any questions of Lewis?
Yes. I have a comment.
Ernie?
I thought I made my original motion vague enough to cover all of this, so there wouldn't be a necessity of having two separate public hearings.
When the invalid.
So, with any, you know, my suggestion was with any concerns staff had. So, this would definitely fall under staff concerns where we'd have to have two public hearings. Or we can conduct it all at one public hearing.
The horseshoe crab, right. They're all they're intertwined. You're correct.
The wilk.
It all affects the same regulations.
No, it affects two different regulations. One's horseshoe crab.
No, he's speaking. 890.
Please.
Mr. Bowden is talking about the public comment who wants to look at the two licenses per board, which would be an 890,
right.
Plus this would be an 890. And
we'd have one public hearing on all of it.
That
two separate public hearings.
We can do that.
And also on 890, I'll point out that we're feeling our way a little bit with these reporting requirements. As you know, the harvesters have traditionally reported, and then we found out with striped bass that it took the buyers to help us out. We're finding that out with horseshoe crabs, finding that out with channeled whelk. So what we advertise may need a little refinement by the time it's all said and done. For example, you know, we have the regulation now drafted as monthly reporting. Something like that may not be necessary for channeled whelk. It would be for horseshoe crab, for example.
Okay.
So we're working on that.
So I guess what we can do is we're going to have a combined public hearing on the initial request. We can do that. Can we do that by consensus? Is that sound good to you all?
Yeah, okay.
Good to me.
Mr. Robbins,
correct. Mr. Robbins.
Question, Dan. On page 2, it says that staff believes no longer need to limit the amount of horseshoe crab fishermen can use to bait each conch pot.
Yes, sir. I should have pointed that out, too. That's something we're removing from that. At the time that was set up, there was a real concern by industry that they'd run out of bait now that we're fishing, now that we have a specific quota. And as a fisherman alluded here earlier, costs have gone up tremendously. Now it's so expensive for the fishermen to use horseshoe crabs for bait, we don't feel that that's even necessary now to mandate the maximum amount of bait they can use. However, there still is conservation in having a bait bag, we believe.
I thought it was had been proven that it didn't make any that part of a horseshoe crab was as effective as...
And in fact, you're exactly right. It was. That's another reason why industry has embraced using that small, by and large, a smaller amount of, rather than using one whole female or two males, they've embraced the idea of using half as much bait. We weren't certain of that when the regulation was amended to include that maximum amount of bait they could use.
So you think the behavior will be acceptable even without this regulation?
Well, even without the mandate on just telling them this is the most amount of bait you can use. Quite frankly, the cost of bait's probably gone up 3 or 4 times what it was 10 years ago. And the bait bag, you're exactly right, the work that Mr. Fisher from VIMS did showed that the catches using half as much bait in a bait bag were essentially the same. So,
okay.
But we do feel that there's still a need for the bait bag itself.
All right. Thank you, Lewis. Item 23, that deals to establish recreational commercial possession limits for blue line tile fishing group or species landed in Virginia.
Did we vote on the last thing?
I think we decided on by consensus that we were going to combine that with the... With the public hearing that the gentleman asked for in public comment.
And, Mr. Chairman, please note that I abstain.
Thank you.
Mr. Commissioner, about 90 seconds. This is a request for April public hearing. Since fall of last year, FMAC has met several times to discuss a growing and directed fishery for tile fish and grouper, which has been developing off the Virginia coast in recent years. This is a complex of fish that are currently unregulated in our region, but are of concern just to our south from North Carolina to Florida. Various measures of management for this complex off Virginia have been recommended. Staff recommends advertising this issue for an April 2007 public hearing to include the following: an FMAC proposal that would establish a maximum recreational possession limit of 12 fish per person per day for tile fish and 3 fish per person per day for grouper, and a maximum commercial possession limit of 300 pounds per person per day for tile fish and 175 pounds per person per day for grouper, with no more than 2 licensed fishermen harvesting per vessel commercially. An original staff proposal that would establish a maximum recreational possession limit of 10 fish per person per day for tile fish, 1 fish per person per day for grouper, and a maximum commercial possession limit of 300 pounds per vessel per day for tile fish and 175 pounds per vessel per day for grouper. And relevant South Atlantic Fishery Management Council regulations pertaining to this complex, which are much stricter, to include a 5 fish aggregate recreational limit.
Any questions or comments from the commission? I'll entertain a motion.
Mr. Chairman, I'd offer to move staff recommendation.
Second. Second by Mr. Bowden. Motion made by Mr. Robbins. Further discussion? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion carries unanimously. And last but not least, item 24, request for a public hearing. Request for revision of the May 1 through October 30th possession limit on spiny dogfish, 3,000 pounds from 600 pounds.
Right. This is a request for April public hearing during the February 2007 Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission's winter meeting. Spiny Dogfish and Coastal Shark Management Board voted to allow states to adopt their own trip limits, not to exceed 3,000 pounds per trip. This was to promote bycatch landings and a small-scale direct fishery for 07-08. Currently, Regulation 4VAC20-490-10 provides for a 600-pound trip limit from May 1 through October 30 and a 4,000-pound trip limit from November 1 through April 30. Staff recommends advertising to establish a new commercial catch limit of 3,000 pounds for spiny dogfish for an April 2007 public hearing.
Any questions from the commission? Entertain a motion. Mr. Hankard.
I recommend that we approve staff's recommendation for new commercial catch limits.
Second by Mr. Holland. Further discussion? All in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries unanimously. Anything else to come before the commission? Jack Travelstead.
There's a little bit of confusion on the sheep's head motion, okay. Item 20. There's going to be considerable debate on this item when you hold the public hearing. And the motion you adopted appeared to lock you into nothing larger than a four-fish possession limit or a 500-pound. What I would suggest you do is allow staff to advertise it, that as a specific recommendation of FMAC, but that the commission will consider alternatives, both more lenient and more restrictive on both of those. We may end up with a smaller commercial limit and a five-fish bag limit, or vice versa. You know, it could go either way. So I would hate to lock you into something where you couldn't go one direction.
Thank you for bringing that to our attention. I did make the motion. I think that's fine.
Okay.
So.
That'd be fine.
Thank you.
Anything else? Philly?
On that item that Mr. Travelstead just brought up, my name is Kelly Place. Because there are some ongoing studies on sheep's head, it would be nice if we were privy to the results, or at least the preliminary results of those studies. I was wondering if the commission would entertain having that public hearing on sheep's head in May instead of April. Thanks.
Thank you. Jack, do you want to respond to that, or do we need...
We had...
Was that in reference to that comment, Tom? That's okay. I'm just trying to sort through the con.
We have had ODU present at the FMAC meetings to discuss their ongoing research, and it was included in your evaluation. Right. We can certainly get him back to report directly to you their results. They're very preliminary at this stage. I'm not sure what'll be. I don't know enough to know what would be gained by delaying it a month. Delaying it a month isn't any problem for staff. I mean, I think the idea was to try to get regulations in place before the summer fishery.
Okay. Let me hear from Tom. Tom, come on.
I would personally request, and I'm sorry to make such a request. I was the one who has been bringing this issue forth through FPAC for 2 years now. I will be out of the country the whole month of May. And so that's just something to consider, and I would like to be here to continue follow up on this.
Okay. Well, Jack,
I did talk to the researcher, and he is willing to show up in April at your commission meeting and speak on this matter. I talked to him about 2 weeks ago.
What? I sense an undercurrent of something here that I'm not really familiar with what's going on. Kelly, one more, and I'm getting ready to adjourn this long meeting. Go ahead.
By the same token, I'll be up probably at Woods Hole at the April meeting, but that's not my concern. My concern is that we'll have a week at most to look at the preliminary results of these studies, which I don't think affords enough time for people to make an educated decision on that issue. I mean, if Mr. Powers will be out on May, sometime after that, but I think April will be too quickly, and that's contingent on if ODU's experts are able to provide the preliminary data on the week before the commission meets. And I think that's really rushed, and I know you all have a lot of things on your agenda. I would ask you that you would consider some sort of postponement. Thanks.
Mr. Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Staff's presenting these as interim management measures, and I think it's important that we keep that in mind. So I don't have any problem with moving ahead and taking this in April.
And motion's already been made to have it in April, so we don't have to do any more. Anything else to come before this body? Meeting adjourned.
Whatever the hard decision.